Chair calls to order the House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Division. Excuse me, and Representative Christensen, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of February 14th?
I approve the minutes from 5th.
Representative Christensen moves adoption of the minutes of February 14th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Pinto, you have House File 1001? Gessler, or 10001 or 10002?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Would you like them moved in that order?
Whatever order you're prepared to.
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, I will move, just to get the bill in front of us, I'll move House File 1001.
So, Representative Pinto moves that House File 1001 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill, 1001, and the next bill, 1002, are both bills that came out of the DWI task force. I've got David Bernstein, hope I'm saying that your name, last name correctly, who's an assistant Minneapolis city attorney and the chair of the task force, here to talk about the bills. You will find in your packet letters from the task force in support of each of the bills, both the one in front of you right now and the one that will be in front of you very shortly. And I think, Mr. Chair, just for time's sake, I'll just turn things over to Mr. Bernstein to describe this bill and then the next one.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bernstein. And let me just thank you for your work and providing leadership for the DWI task force. Look forward to your testimony today. Please begin with stating your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI task force. For those who are unfamiliar, the DWI task force is a volunteer organization. We are not funded. We are not affiliated. We are a group of individuals that meet monthly throughout the year regarding all things DWIs. We go over case law. We discuss DWIs in the media, and we do go over legislation, occasionally lobbying for legislation, and also supporting, opposing, or remaining neutral on DWI-related legislation. Members of the task force appear in their individual capacities, but they do bring a unique knowledge of DWI law. The task force consists of judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, probation officers, law enforcement, Office of Traffic Safety, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, private businesses, any others who have an interest in DWIs. So we have a unique set, a variety of knowledge that attend our meetings. The task force did discuss House File 1001, and we voted to support this bill. We had initially proposed this bill back in 2015. Essentially, this bill does a couple of things. First of all, it allows for license plate impoundment to be effectuated by affixing a permanent sticker upon the license plate. In certain DWI-related cases, the license plate is actually removed from the vehicle, which is license plate impoundment. It's meant to be a measure for public safety. This can present problems to law enforcement. Occasionally, the license plates can be rusty or dirty. It can be very difficult and time-consuming to remove license plates from the vehicle roadside. And so part of the reason for this bill is to allow law enforcement to affix a permanent sticker, which effectuates the impoundment. It takes much less time. It's much less dangerous to that law enforcement officer remaining roadside. It allows that officer to respond to other calls, but it still effectuates the license plate impoundment. In addition, this bill increases the temporary license from 7 days to 14 days, or in the cases involving blood or urine evidentiary tests, for 45 days. There are a few reasons for this proposal. First, 7 days is a short period of time for individuals to make arrangements for transportation. In addition to that, the increase to 14 days would allow individuals more time to try and get on ignition interlock and to drive legally. With respect to the 45 days, in the cases of blood or urine tests, those samples are sent to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension for testing. Typically, those test results don't come back for at least 45 days. So rather than immediately revoke the license, this gives that person a period of time until those results come back, or at least a longer period of time until that case is charged out. And so the task force believes that this bill is fair and it is in the interest of public safety. So for those reasons, the DWI Task Force does support House File 1001 and ask that it be included or considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee has. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Representative Pinto, do you have any other testifiers?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair.
All right, very well. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify in this bill? If not, we do have a question from Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Pinto, maybe you can answer this question for me. One thing, I myself have filled out a number of impounded plates and removed the plates. Even in greater Minnesota, generally, you don't have a problem pulling the plates off while we're waiting for the tow truck to arrive. But the question I have is, on that form, we also have to list all vehicles that are registered to the driver. How does this bill deal with the other vehicles that aren't there? And instead of requiring the people to bring them in, do they have to bring the plate in now so we can affix the sticker, or do we have to go find all the vehicles?
Representative Pinto.
And Mr. Chair, I think I'll have our expert, Mr. Bernstein, respond to that if he can.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I think the procedure would be similar in that they would list the other vehicles. I don't know that there's a procedure in place to affix the stickers. However, similarly, I don't know that there's a procedure in place to remove license plates from other vehicles. And so I don't think this bill would change that procedure in any way.
Very well.
Chair Mariani, just so the people know, that the people are required to bring those license plates into the department. And then they're given their 20, or I believe those vehicles had a longer temporary sticker. But I'm also wondering on the 45, changing it to that 45-day for the blood and urine tests. I know for myself and my department, if we did a blood or urine test, we wouldn't do the impoundment until after we got the information back from the state. We wouldn't, if we don't have a test and the test results, we would not impound the plates until after we got the verified information unless the person refused the test.
Mr. Burns, maybe Mr. Bernstein. Maybe Mr. Bernstein has a comment.
Mr. Bernstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can't speak on behalf of law enforcement agencies, but I do think that they might handle that differently. And I do think that some agencies have impounded the plates with blood or urine testing involved, is my understanding. And so this would allow for a 45-day temporary permit in those cases.
I was just wondering, Mr. Chair, if there's anybody from law enforcement that could explain that procedure, if it's a blood or urine test, and how they do the impoundment.
Is there anyone here from law enforcement in the audience that can address this issue? Please come forward, sir. Welcome to the committee, sir, and please give us your name for the record. And I think you heard the question. If not, we can have it repeated.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jeff Tate. I'm the police chief for the city of Shakopee and a member of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association Board of Directors. Mr. Chair, Representative, if we have a vehicle that individual that we arrest for a gross misdemeanor and we have probable cause to arrest that individual, we will seize the plates at that time, whether it's blood, urine, or breath test.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chief, is that your department policy, or are you following state policy in that regards?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I believe that's what most law enforcement do, is impounding the plate at that time.
So, Chief, this is a policy of the police department in Shakopee, then.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, it's what we do in Scott County. I would say that's what our direction is in Scott County.
Very well, thank you. Representative Johnson.
I guess that'll lead me to another question I have, Mr. Chair. If you do that before you have the test results back and it comes back that the individual was not legally intoxicated and they're not under the requirements of the forfeiture law, does the department pay for the renewed for the new license plates, or is the individual still responsible for that?
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not pay for that, no.
Thank you, Chief. Representative Considine. Okay, very well. If there are no further questions, then Representative Pinto renews his motion. Is there something? Representative Grasso, please. Yes, please.
For the author or the testifier, maybe also for the chief as well, where does the Chiefs of Police Association, Sheriff's Association, and the troopers stand as far as this possible change?
I don't know. I'm not aware of them having taken a position on the bill, but Mr. Bernstein or the chief, I suppose, may know something different.
Mr. Bernstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel, the DWI task force has members from State Patrol, from the Chiefs of Police, many individual agencies, and while they don't represent their agencies, they do bring this information back to their agencies and bring me feedback. And the feedback I have received universally is that law enforcement does support this bill.
Very well. With that, Representative Pinto, last words.
No, thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, the chair will lay House File 1001 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Chief, and thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Representative Pinto, you have House File 1002, and I believe your motion is to have it referred to the Transportation Committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Representative Pinto so moves, and are we doing the amendment right away? And Representative Pinto, I see you have an A1 amendment.
Indeed, I do, Mr. Chair. So this will get the bill in the shape that we'd like it to. It'll also match as it's moving in the other body. And sorry to ask for members' approval of the A1 amendment.
Very well. So Representative Pinto moves the A1. Amendment to put the bill in the shape he wishes it to be before us. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chair. So this is the second bill from the DWI task force. There's a letter again from the task force that discusses its support for the bill and describes it. I'll turn things over to Mr. Bernstein to very briefly describe the bill. This is a relatively simple change that I hope will meet members' satisfaction.
Very well. Mr. Bernstein, please restate your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. The DWI Task Force supports House File 1002. This was another bill that we had previously proposed, I believe, in 2015. What this bill essentially does is whenever a DWI offender is trying to get their license reinstated, they are required to take a DWI written test. This written test is provided by the Department of Public Safety. My understanding is that the offender needs to transport themselves to the testing center in order to take this written test as one of the requirements to get their driver's license back. This bill eliminates the requirement to take the DWI written test. I want to stress that the DWI task force wants to improve public safety on Minnesota's roadways. And so this bill might seem counterintuitive, but essentially it is duplicative and not necessary. Whenever an offender is charged with a DWI, or actually is convicted of a DWI, Minnesota statutes require a chemical dependency evaluation. That chemical dependency evaluation evaluates the individual and what level of education or treatment that individual might need. And the DWI task force supports education that's more focused on the individual as opposed to the group. So some chemical health assessments will require an 8-hour class. Some will require a 16-hour class. Some require a class that's taken over the course of multiple weeks. But the level of education is tailored towards that individual. The task force believes that that is a better approach. As a matter of fact, most courts require that individuals take a class. In Hennepin County, for example, there's a Hennepin County one-day DWI program that's required of all first-time offenders, and that is an 8-hour class. It's much more expansive than the DWI written test that's provided by the Department of Public Safety. And so the task force feels that this requirement is redundant and not necessary. More importantly, this is a barrier towards obtaining a valid license. There are multiple steps that are necessary. And the task force has received feedback that many individuals choose to drive illegally rather than take the steps to obtain a valid driver's license. And one of the barriers is this DWI written test. Some people in rural Minnesota aren't able to transport themselves to the testing center in order to take the test. In places where public transportation is not as available, they can't get a ride, they have a revoked license, so they can't drive themselves. And so they continue driving illegally, picking up driving after revocation offenses, they get in the system. Many people who drive illegally also don't drive with insurance. And so if an individual is able to obtain a valid driver's license, they're driving legally, they have insurance, and that is safer for Minnesota's roadways. It also allows individuals an easier time to get on the ignition interlock system, which the DWI task force supports and also improves public safety on Minnesota's roadways. So for those reasons, the task force supports House File 1002 and respectfully asks that it be included in the omnibus bill. Again, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Very well, Mr. Bernstein. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? If not, then Representative Pinto, we are open for questions from the members.
Indeed, Mr. Chair. Open for questions.
Representative Grosso.
Same question as last time, Representative. I guess, would you, since you just have the consensus of a few on the board, would you be willing to check with those agencies, see where their stance is on these, on both these bills, if you would, if you'd be so kind?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grosso, yes, I'd be really glad to do that, Representative Grosso. We'll check with the organizations that you referenced, and thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Grosso. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, do you know if the Department of Public Safety supports this?
Representative Pinto.
And the same thing, if I heard you right, Representative Johnson, I think you said Department of Public Safety, and the same thing that I'm not aware of anything in particular, but Mr. Bernstein may have. I assume folks on the task force, there may be somebody representative of the department on the task force as well, but I'll turn things over to him to answer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bernstein.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, members, Representative Johnson, again, individuals don't represent their agencies, but the feedback I've received is that the Department of Public Safety does support this initiative. I don't know if they've officially taken that stance, but the feedback I've received is that they do support this bill.
Very well. Representative Pinto, you get the last word here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Very well. Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 1002, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Pinto and, Mr. Bernstein. Thank you for your testimony today and also for your citizen volunteer work on the DWI task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Very well. Chair Lesh, we have House File 1061. And Chair Lesh, I believe your motion is to have House File 1061 be re-referred to the Transportation Committee.
So yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Very well. Representative Lesh, your bill is before us with a motion to be re-referred to the Transportation Committee. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my testifiers can speak to this much better than I can. However, I would note that this bill stops driver's license suspensions only when the only violation is failure to pay traffic tickets. It eliminates the additional suspension period after paying a ticket for driving after suspension, so people who pay their fine can get back to work, and it maintains a collection process. It also, I would note, does not impact suspensions for DWI, reckless driving, or habitual offenders. But noting, Mr. Chair, that my testifiers can speak to this better than me, I'd ask you to permit them to speak to this.
Very well, Chair Lesh. And whoever wants to start can again, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leah Jackson.
I originally grew up in Otsego, and I live in Minneapolis. I'm a server, bartender, and a dance instructor through St. Paul Parks and Rec. Thanks for the chance for me to tell you about how this the driving suspensions have caused significant impact on me both financially and occupationally. So this starts back 2014 in October. I was taking a left turn at a green light yield, and I pulled out into the intersection like I was taught how to do, and I was waiting for the break in traffic, giving me the time to turn. But as the light turned yellow, everyone started speeding up and didn't give me that time. So then I was sitting in the middle of the intersection until I was able to go when the light was already red. I was pulled over immediately and then told that that is illegal. I was given a ticket for obstructing traffic and intersection gridlock. And originally that was a $135 ticket. And I was 20 at the time. I just got a new job at a store as a store manager. I was actually in Rochester on training, so I wasn't even home. I was driving back to the hotel when that happened. And then I just moved into my very own apartment for the first time by myself. And I hadn't gotten a first paycheck yet, and I had to save up for rent. I had a lot more responsibility than I had ever been used to. So I didn't, you know, I was going to wait a little bit to pay my ticket. So just get my feet on the ground. But then I didn't know that there was a time limit on it. So the following February, I was pulled over and told that my license was suspended. And I had been given the driving after suspension ticket, which if I remember was like 280 something at the time. I ended up paying a lot less, but that's what it would have been. And then I was never notified of that suspension. And since I had just moved, but my license, my driver's license was still my parents' address because that was my mailing address, and I never got a notification there or my apartment. So I had no idea that I was suspended until I was pulled over. So now about 500 in fines. So I knew in February I was, okay, when I get my tax return, that's when I'm going to pay everything back. I was actually able to go, actually, hold on. So I still had to wait a little bit because I didn't have the money. So I kept driving. My responsibilities at work as a store manager was bank runs, and then I had a couple different delivery responsibilities that I had as a tuxedo and prom store. So within about 2 weeks of that first driving after suspension ticket, I got two more, one for driving to the bank and one for driving to my second job as a dance instructor. So at that point, I had to ask friends to drive me to the bank. I had to ask friends to drive me to work just because I didn't have that much time between jobs to take the bus. It was like a two-hour bus ride, so that wasn't an option for me at the time. And then, you know, on days when I wasn't a store manager, it was just very stressful because, you know, I was in trouble. That was stressful, and then I could never really visit my family, which lived about 45 minutes away. So then finally when my tax return came back, I actually went to court and talked to a hearing officer, and those three driving after suspension fines went from 900 to about 600. So I was really grateful for that at the time. But I paid it off and was able to get my license back. But that's not where, you know, the problems ended. So because of those tickets, my auto insurance company had dropped me as a client. And after companies and companies of trying to get quotes and stuff, either they didn't accept me at all or nothing less for $1,000 a month. So luckily, now this time I was a server, so I was connected through a broker, through a customer. His son was actually an insurance broker, and he was able to get me insurance for $650, which was very happy at the time because that's, what, $350 less than what I was looking at. So now it's 4.5 years later, and I'm finally down to only $200 a month, which to me is actually pretty great considering $650 is what I was paying at the time. But now after these 4.5 years, all of the fees and fines that I've paid and then all of the insurance that I've paid, it's just under about $16,000 that I've paid just because of that one ticket that would have been avoided if I just had a little bit more time to pay it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Jackson, for your testimony. I don't think Franz Kafka could have written a more concise Representative Lesh, Chair Lesh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellen Hang. I am the Minneapolis criminal deputy in the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. I have been a misdemeanor prosecutor for 21 years. I started in the office in 1997, our office, we only do misdemeanor prosecutions of adults. The county attorney does the felonies and the juvenile work. And I am here to testify on behalf of my office, and I've had communications with the St. Paul City Attorney's Office as well, and I know they support this bill and have worked with us in partner. But I'm here to testify in support of this bill. I can just tell you from my years of experience that tying driving privileges to financial obligations just simply doesn't work. We have groups of people that are simply, no matter what we do, they're just not going to take responsibility for their tickets. And yes, this law is going to assist them, but I think that's a very small group of people that we encounter. But the truth is that we encounter a lot more people that simply want to do the right thing and don't have the financial means to do it. And traffic tickets, if you aren't really familiar with the system, as you can see from Leah's story, not only can it be really daunting and a confusing and complicated process, but they can add up very, very quickly. We are a proud partner of the Driver Diversion Program, which we've used for many, many years now to help people like Leah get their license back by paying off their tickets. And I have seen people apply for that program who have $8,000-$10,000 worth of outstanding tickets. One ticket can quickly balloon from the normal fine of a couple hundred dollars into $700 or $800 by the time you tack on late fees, delinquency fees, collection fees. And all the while, people have to continue to drive because they need to get to work in order to make money, support their family, and pay off their fine. So we've just created this vicious, vicious cycle. And the other thing I've learned is that when someone doesn't have a valid driver's license, they often don't have valid insurance. And for me as a prosecutor, what I want on the roads are valid, licensed, good drivers. And right now we have thousands of drivers that are driving around unlicensed and uninsured. And this law does not do anything to people who are out there driving recklessly, driving under the influence, who continue to violate laws habitually. I fully support revoking and suspending licenses for conduct. What I cannot support anymore is simply suspending licenses for people who simply are just too poor to pay. And we have to make a change to make the road safer. In my office, 20 to 30% of our caseload is spent on people coming into court on driving after suspension, driving after revocation tickets. I don't think that that's a very good use of our legal resources when we have other cases, the repeat drunk driver, the hit and runs, the domestic assaults, the weapons cases. Those are the cases I would like to see my attorneys focus their time on, not the person who is driving to their third job because they don't have public transportation that works well for their schedule simply because they couldn't afford to pay off one traffic ticket that they got. So I fully support this bill. I think it's the right time to make this change, and I think it will, in fact, make the roads safer. So thank you.
Thank you, Deputy City Attorney Hang. And we also have, I believe, Jeanette Berner.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I apologize for some of you already heard this last week, so it's going to be a little redundant. But my name is Jeanette Berner. As I indicated, I'm the first assistant public defender in Hennepin County. The public defender's office in the state of Minnesota is the largest criminal defense firm in the state of Minnesota. We represent 57% of all criminal defense cases in the state and approximately 61% of them in Hennepin County. Public defender clients who are eligible are clients who are charged with criminal offenses and fall below the federal poverty guidelines. For a family of four, that's a $24,000 income. For an individual, it's a $12,000 annual income. But the reality is that our clients look much different than that for the most part. Many of the people who I have represented in my 25 years of practice are homeless or between housing, are unemployed or between employment, and are frankly just destitute. The reality is that in this state, particularly in outstate Minnesota, you need to have a license to be able to work, to be able to provide for your family. I think in the Twin Cities, we're more fortunate in that we have a public transportation system and the ability to quickly use an Uber or a Lyft, but the same can't be said for many of my colleagues in outstate Minnesota and the clients who they serve. If you are poor, the suspension is dramatic. The amount of money that you owe is more money than you can get in a month to provide for your family. Most of the tickets, as indicated, are about $130, and we're not even going into all the other surcharges and fines and fees. And as I indicated, many of my clients live on less than that a week. I think it creates a tremendous disparity between people who have means and people who do not. And it goes without saying that this has a tremendous impact on communities of color. I think it's pretty well known that you're more likely to be stopped by law enforcement if your license is suspended. There are thousands of hours that we spend, and Ms. Hang indicated, on these suspension cases. And public defenders would like to be able to dedicate their time to more serious cases. I think you're well aware, I'm sure you've heard from Mr. Ward and Mr. Kier about our caseloads and our funding, and we would like to be able to focus our time and energy on cases that require our time and energy. That's not to say that we dismiss these cases and we don't care. We do, but it takes a tremendous amount of our resources, and if you heard her numbers of the cases that come into the system, we're paralleling our representation on those cases. I would conclude by telling you that this is a national trend. We're sort of last in line to do something about this. In Washington, the state of Washington stopped suspending driver's license for unpaid tickets in 2012. In California, they stopped in 2017. Mississippi stopped suspending the driver's license for these tickets in December of 2017. And most recently, a Tennessee federal court followed suit and declared that collecting debt from an indigent debtor is not a rational basis for revoking a license. No rational creditor wants his debtor to be sidelined from productive economic life or less able to hold a job or cover other competing living expenses. And they conclude, the loss of one's ability to drive compromises a person's capacity for economic self-sufficiency. You cannot underestimate the value of a driver's license in our society. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Public Defender Berner. We do have several questions. There also is A1 amendment. We'll see if someone wants to move that. But in the meantime, I have Representative Grassl and Representative Long. Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just before your first testifier there. You said your license was still addressed as your parents' residence?
Yes.
Ms. Jackson?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess my question is, as far as the fine goes, how long ago was this? Was it 4 years or five?
Ms. Jackson?
It was 4.5 years ago when I originally got the first ticket in October of 2014.
Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess why didn't you ask your folks for the change to help you with that citation to save you, like you said, about $16,000?
Ms. Jackson.
Family dynamic wasn't for me to be asking them for money. It was I did it all. I did everything by myself.
Okay. All right. I've heard this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard your story. I believe it was last session as well, and in this session now a couple times. And I'm just kind of curious because that's what if my daughter at that age had received a citation, you know, and needed some help, would have gladly done it. And I guess hindsight being 2020, I guess maybe. You're thinking you should have found a friend or somebody that would spot you the money so that you could avoid, not knowing what was coming, you could have avoided a heck of a lot of headache, wouldn't you?
Yes, sir. Ms. Jackson, I suspect, like most of us, we learn the hard way sometimes. And, but please, we wish to respond. Representative Grassl?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what's my question?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry, you done, Representative?
Yeah, I'm done with the young lady.
Okay.
I had a couple more questions for the other testifiers, all if right. I may.
Please.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I, you know, I mean, not all families are in a situation where a family could help
Representative Dean, why don't we hold that to, I see you are on the list, and you'll have an opportunity to express that. Representative Glasser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. County Attorney, you said you made the statement that there are just some groups that just aren't going to take responsibility for their citations, and also follow that with, you know, we're probably going to be helping them to continue to be irresponsible. Is that really what we want to do with this?
City Attorney Hay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What I meant by that statement is I do think, I mean, I see people come into court all the time and, you know, they don't show up. And, you know, they don't care that they have a bench warrant out there. They're going to just do their thing. And we do see that in the system. What I would say to that is that right now those people are having a suspended license because they're not paying their fines, and it's not deterring their behavior. I mean, they're still probably out there driving. They're still not coming to court. And so the number of people that we're going to benefit by making this change, people that want to truly be responsible and simply don't have the means to do it, I think in an ideal world, everyone would step up and take responsibility, but that's just not reality. And so while it may allow people to not lose their driving privilege, there will be consequences still. They will have the collection piece of it, and that may or may not impact them depending on their ability. But I think while there may be a small percentage of people that, you know, will now be able to drive legally and still ignore their tickets, the number of people that we're going to help, I think, is more important than that small group that simply, I mean, never show up for court, don't take any responsibility. I don't know, short of, you know, holding them in jail until the case is resolved, which, you know, we're trying to change that practice. Mm-hmm. I think there's always going to be that small group, but I think the good that this bill will do will far outweigh the fact that there are going to be a few that are going to take advantage of this change.
Representative Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as far as that goes, you know, I like the idea, and I do believe there are things in place through the courts for people that have, who are indigent, who do not have the means to pay it right away or up front, that they will work it out with them, that they can make payments or installments on these things. Is that not still a practice?
Mr. Chairman, yes. You have lots of options when you get a traffic ticket. They're what's called payable offenses, and the state court has deemed certain misdemeanor offenses that you can basically reduce to a petty misdemeanor if you want to pay a set fine and dollar amount, and that includes all the surcharges and whatnot. And if you have the means to do that and you're not concerned about any collateral consequences, you can go on your computer and you can just simply pay the fine. The people that we're talking about don't have the full fine amount, so their only option is to either come to see a hearing officer in Hennepin or Ramsey County first and try to get that fine reduced or get some ability to work that fine off, or they have to come to court and see a prosecutor and plea bargain that case down. And again, you know, that takes them away from jobs where often they don't have paid sick time. You know, it forces people to, again, make really hard choices of, do I take the time off of work to come and try to get a reduced fine, or do I just go to work and not worry about it? So, yes, there is the ability, and I think, you know, as a prosecutor, I certainly try to take all circumstances into account and give a fine that I think is going to give a meaningful consequence based on income. Not all prosecutors do that, though. Some prosecutors, mm-hmm. I would imagine, don't have to plea bargain. I have to in my office. We're doing, you know, 17,000 cases a year, and by the sheer volume, we have to make deals, and we have to decide when that's appropriate and when we stick to our guns. And certainly on these cases, these are the kind of cases that we do plead down and we negotiate the fines because we have to in order to spend our time on the more serious offenses. But I think the fact is, these people still have to take time off of work. They have to come in. They have to sit through a morning calendar all to get that process in place. And, again, it takes away from their ability to work at these jobs. And I think it's just better not to put them in that position in the first place.
Sure. Representative Grassel, we do have a long list of your colleagues also have questions, but please okay. Proceed.
So I guess, you know, it's I like the idea, Representative Lesh. I like the idea, you know, to help people. And that's what I always try to do as a deputy myself, is to help the people that I encountered. But to reward irresponsibility with nothing, with no fines or anything like that, you know, that's a little harder thing to swallow. Mr. Chair, just one more for the defense.
Just quickly.
Objection asked and answered.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to answer? My apologies.
City Attorney Hank. Or, I'm sorry, who are we?
Did you? I didn't
oh, so well, so oh, I thought Rick Rutledge had one more thing.
No. No.
You know, it's in listening to the one statement you made about people of color being more likely to be stopped. I'll have to agree to disagree with you on that one, because as a patrol deputy myself, I never looked at the color of a person's skin. It was the conduct that caused me to stop those, make those traffic stops. And working a lot of night shifts, I can't see who's in that vehicle. So to make a broad statement as law enforcement does this, I'll have to disagree with you on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a little broader than that, and I really respect what you're saying. I think it has a lot to do with socioeconomic circumstances, and that community of colors, particularly in Hennepin County, are poorer, and poorer people are not able to pay their fines and fees, and therefore their licenses are suspended. And so you know that you can run that plate not knowing who's in the car, right, to your point. And if you're suspended, it's a basis to pull you over, and therefore it does have an indirect impact. So I'm not casting aspersions or saying there's a motive, and I'm not trying to open up that can of worms to make sure we all are here for the next 3 hours. But, you know, and I know it would, but I think it's fair to say just logistically, it does have, it's proven statistically to have an impact on communities of color, and that's my point.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Grassel. Representative Long and then Representative Dean.
But I wasn't done. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief so we can move along. I just was going to mention to the first testifier, thank you for sharing the story. That I think it's always difficult to share stories like that, but it's a really important example. And you were in a tough position, which was that you needed to work to make money. You needed to drive to work. And it was actually part of your job to drive, right? And so you were put in a really tough spot that you had to drive to make money to pay back your ticket, but by doing that, you were incurring even more fines. So that was putting you in a really impossible situation to be able to do that. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and also mention that you're not alone and you're not unique. There was a study done last year that 57% of Americans couldn't make a $500 emergency payment if it came up. So you're actually speaking for a majority of Americans and not being able to make a payment for an emergency, bill that comes due. And a lot of that 57%, I would bet, don't have a parent they could call or a friend they could call to be able to get $500 in an emergency basis, or $900 as the fees built up. So just wanted to thank you for being present and sharing your story. And I think you represent a lot of people who are in this downward spiral through no fault of their own or through a fault that they want to pay, no fault that they're poor. And they want to take action on paying their ticket, but often aren't able to. So thank you to the bill sponsor for bringing this forward.
Indeed, well said. Ms. Jackson, one of the, I think, powerful things of the state legislature in Minnesota, I can't speak for other states, is that we do transparently open up our deliberations during this period of our legislative session so we can hear directly from people of all views who are directly impacted by our laws. And so putting a face on the law is critically important to all of us here in the legislature. Thank you for offering that opportunity to put a face on the issues that this law is seeking to address. Representative Dean and Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also thank you, Ms. Jackson, for your testimony. We have a terrible system. When people are in financial difficulties and they aren't able to pay a small fine, their lives can be totally upended. And I don't know why we do this. I don't know why we criminalize poverty, because we do. If someone gets a fine and they can't pay it, the next thing you know, their license is suspended. They can't pay that fine. We want them to work. We want them to do all the things that they're trying to do, but they're starting from an extra 30, 40 yards back, and it almost makes it impossible. And, you know, we can talk about law enforcement and how they pull people over and all those other things. You know, clearly, if you're driving a suspended license, that's cause. But oftentimes people get pulled over for equipment violations. You know, and people that get new cars every 3 years tend not to have equipment violations. It tends to be people that are driving 10, 15-year-old cars. Just, by the way, I'm breaking the law right now. One of my headlights is out. I fear in my neighborhood when I drive there, because if I was living somewhere else, I probably wouldn't have an issue with that. But I live in North Minneapolis. And it's possible tonight that when I go home, I'll get pulled over because I have a headlamp that's out. Now, I'm going to be at a huge advantage from a lot of the other people in my community because the officer is going to see that I'm white, and it will probably be handled very, very differently. You know, and we can talk about who gets pulled over. I mean, I've lived on the north side almost 20 years. I've driven down streets sometimes 5, 6, 7 times a day, some of the busiest streets in North Minneapolis, and I've never gotten pulled over. And this isn't the first time my headlight's been out. So I think that we know that poorer communities are impacted in very, very different ways, and that we really need to move beyond criminalizing people being poor in this insidious downward spiral of fines and fees and fines on top of fees on fines on top of fees. So I think this is definitely a bill we should move forward, and we should stop making people's lives harder and start making it a little bit better for them.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief, and I too want to thank Ms. Jackson for your testimony. I, as a city council member in Richfield, had a constituent who had a very similar issue, trapped in this cycle, and I know they would be grateful for you sharing your story and raising up this issue. And it is a cycle of folks racking up fines, needing to drive to work, and there was some mention of just sort of the collateral weight for our public safety systems. You know, our police department in Richfield knew this individual was driving without a license, would see them and felt compelled to pull them over. They were also, I think they would be grateful for us looking at this issue and changing the system, which it just strikes me as the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and again and expecting a different result. And we just don't really have a practical system here to deliver accountability and justice. So I think this bill is a helpful nod in the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Howard. We have Representative Johnson, Considine, O'Neill, and then we have an A1 amendment. I want to see if anyone wants to author that, and then we'll proceed from there. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, my first question, just wondering with the Public Defender's Office, which traffic-related offenses did the Public Defender's Office assist with? Was it just speeding, or did they have to get to a reckless, careless DWI in that area?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative
Public
Johnson.
Defender Berner, we also do have the State Public Defender.
Would you
Ward
like to take
available.
It, Mr. Ward?
Who can help with that?
My boss has given me permission to answer this. We represent all misdemeanor crimes for which the person appears in court. So if a person has a payable offense, which could be a misdemeanor, and they elect to pay it online, then we don't get involved in that. But if they do schedule a court appearance, we represent them. So anybody who's facing a loss of liberty, incarceration, so that's a misdemeanor, that's punishable by 90 days, a gross misdemeanor by a year, and a felony more than a year, we our representation kicks in.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I just want to let people know that if it is a misdemeanor or higher, not a speeding ticket or anything like that, but if it's a misdemeanor or higher, the Public Defender's Office is there to help if they qualify. And for the prosecutor, I know in my county and the counties I've worked in, I've been to court in a number of different counties. And all the prosecutors, whether it's city or county, they always plea bargain whenever they can. And if somebody comes in and has a situation that they need assistance, in my area, the county attorney has no problem working with them. Unfortunately, the state went to a system where it was a central payment system. And that system was very messed up. I know a couple of my friends who had their license suspended, and they had the documentation they paid because the system didn't notify the court system. They had to pay their reinstatement fees to get it back. The reason I found out about it, law enforcement at one time, I don't know if it's still done, they're sent a list of suspended drivers every year, every month. It might be every week or every month in their neighborhoods for DWIs and stuff like that. So the county attorneys and the city prosecutors do work with the people if they have issues. We had a very robust conversation about this issue in the judiciary. And the biggest issue that they're having with, and even the public defenders and even some of the judges admit, it's the surcharges. They cannot be waived. Our surcharges are more than a lot of times, sometimes double what the fines are. And that's an issue we do need to work on. But last question I actually have, I'll let whoever wants to answer it answer this. The issue is, and they talked about it, there's a few people that never pay their fines and their tickets. They don't contact the courts to make arrangements for payments. And that's a simple, that's just a phone call to the prosecutor, and they can make arrangements for the court to pay the fines. It's real easy to do. I know people have done it numerous times. The issue is these people that never take care of it. I understand the meaning of this bill, and I have no problem with it, except for the fact that these people can get, technically, they can have 100 moving violations, and the way this is written, if they don't pay them, nothing happens. They could have 100 speeding tickets. Nothing happens until they finally pay them. Then their license could be suspended because they have more than 4 violations in 12 months or 24 months. But until they pay those tickets, there's no convictions. There's nothing on their record. And if a ticket is not paid, it doesn't go on their record. So I think we need to really take a close look at this. And I do have an amendment that I am be bringing up to talk about. But what I'm going to have the prosecutor ask us, what should we do with these people that continually refuse to pay their fines?
City Attorney Hang, if you can answer this question, I do want to get to your amendment, whoever is offering that amendment. We still do have 2 members that have questions. Members, if we're not done with our agenda today, we will be recessing and reconvening at 5 p.m. in room 300 South. But City Attorney Hay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have that problem now. Without this bill, whether you pass this bill or not, that problem exists. And it doesn't exist just for driving offenses. In Hennepin County, they decided that we needed to look at and clean up old warrants. So last year, I was sent a list of no less than 50,000 misdemeanor offenses of all sorts that are in warrant status for the last 5 years. And they said, what do you want to do with those? And they were everything from serious offenses, people on warrant status on a DWI, to a consuming in public, to a driving after revocation. And there were certain offenses I looked at and said, well, this is 5 years old, and on my scale of, you know, what really impacts public safety, I said, we just need to dismiss them. What am I going to do if this person comes in and 5 years later, I don't even know if the officer's still on the force? We have that problem right now. So this bill is not going to make that problem better. It's not going to make it worse. But the benefit that we're going to do to people that are in this spiral that's been talked about is far outweighed by that group of people that right now are doing nothing and just taking their chances of never getting picked up on their warrant or that. I don't know what we do to bring people into court so that we can hold them responsible for any level of offense. But that problem exists all throughout the state, throughout the country, and passing or not passing this bill is not going to change that. There are just some people that, frankly, just don't care about the laws, think they don't apply, and they're just going to do their thing until they get caught and are forced to deal with it. But the number of people, what I found, especially, you know, working with the driving diversion program, one of the things I really was surprised about is when given the chance to be accountable and try to do the right thing, a lot of people really want to do that. They just need to be able to do it in a way that makes sense for them financially. And that is often a payment plan. For some people, a payment plan of $10 a month is a meaningful payment plan. It's all they can afford. And I really think that the majority of people want to be responsible and they want the system to work with them so that they can be responsible, take accountability. Everybody makes mistakes, and you know, you shouldn't have this lifelong, you know, 5 or 6 year struggle for one mistake that you made. I mean, who hasn't, you know, gotten a ticket? I've gotten several tickets. I mean, it happens. It's life. And so while I understand your concern, I really encourage you and other lawmakers not to focus on that group, because they're going to exist regardless of what you do. But I think we have to look at the people that are trying to be responsible, that need some help. And I do think maybe if I had less of these cases, I might be able to, you know, some of these offenses are payable offenses, and the way I can bring them into court is by charging by a complaint. I don't have the resources in my office to have an attorney, you know, cranking out, you know, complaints on all of these misdemeanor offenses. But if my caseload is reduced by 20 or 30%, maybe I can look at some of these offenses, say, this is important enough, I'm going to have somebody do a complaint, we'll bring them into court that way, see if that will get them into court. So I understand the concern, but I think, you know, this bill is going to do more benefit than harm, and those people are always going to exist regardless of what you do.
Thank you, City Attorney Hagg. I'm thinking of a couple traffic tickets over the years that I've forgotten, and I paid more than I should have paid in the first place. You know, I eventually caught up. I didn't pay $60,000 or have my insurance, rates skyrocket. So the collateral damages for a simple error and small misjudgment, is something that is about certain people paying the price. Representative Constantine and Representative O'Neill, and then we're going to go to the amendment if someone's going to offer it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chairman Lesh, for bringing this bill. I mentioned it the other day. Tomorrow we'll be seeing a bill that I have that will enhance the penalties for death and maiming, and Ms. Jackson is not the person I want to catch or be prosecuted with that. We need to make sure that the suspensions are for people that need it and that have egregious backgrounds. So thank you for bringing this forward. Otherwise, I don't think I could bring my bill forward. One other little thing, and I know, Representative Grossel, you meant this in the best possible way, and I have a daughter that would have come to me too, but we can't assume that people have the same resources that we do. That just be something in general for us to keep in mind. And again, I know what you're saying because, yeah, my daughter to come to me, I'd have written a check. But that's not what everybody's experience is.
That was exactly my point was, you know, Mr. Chair. It just baffled me, and I was just thinking about it.
Right. I understand where you're coming from. We need to be careful about assuming that everybody has the same advantages.
I don't assume anything. I don't assume anything, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Thank you both. We do have a good committee, I have to say, here, in terms of folks who are carefully trying to think through the issues. Representative O'Neill, and then Representative Mullen, I did forget you, and then we'll get to the amendment if someone's going to offer. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question about the actual bill. So if we can maybe return back to the bill language.
Thank you, Representative
O'Neill. You know, unique. Let's talk about the bill. Chair Lesh, this is something that I had brought up the last time you had the bill. I love the bill. I do have concerns only because of the change that we were talking about when you're talking about reinstatement fees, and it was a change in policy, not necessarily a change in statute. And so I just bring that up again. I noticed that you didn't have an amendment. I was hoping to have something that would clarify it. Maybe I should have brought an amendment, which would have been fine too, but it's on page 5 and it's lines 5.24 through 5.26. And it really has to do more with now that MNLARS is up and operational and they are stacking up these violations that have caused the license to be need to be reinstated, I guess is the best way to say it. So it's $20 per reinstatement. And I'm wondering if maybe you want to think about, since it's really a reinstatement fee, which seems like a single action, to make it clear in statute so that instead of them paying a stacked $20 for every violation that brought that need to be reinstated, to have it be a single fee of $20 instead of a stacked fee of $20 however many times. So that's all I was going to bring up, is just something that I hope that you can clarify so we don't have yet another impediment to someone getting their license back.
Ms. Chair and Representative O'Neill, yeah, I would like to do that. What's the path from here? I think Mr. Lundy
Chairman
just reminded
Lush,
me.
I believe we're going to be referring this to the Committee on Transportation.
Okay. And where do we know where it's going after that?
Possibly to your committee.
Oh, back to me. Okay.
I'll leave that to you.
So, yeah, we'll get that drafted and offer it, and you're on my committee, so when it comes back, maybe we can do that. But I totally agree with you on it. Thank you.
Yeah. Terrific.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make sure that we pointed that out, because it's, you know, if we're really trying to make it easier for folks to get their licenses back, not because of financial hardship, that actually is a pretty big financial hardship if it's not just one single $20 fee to reinstate, but multiple. And so it was just something that sort of came up at the last hearing, kind of a surprise when we were going through the bill. So just something that we should fix going forward. Thanks.
I agree, Representative O'Neill. Thank you for bringing that issue on the record. Representative Mullers, okay, so there is an A1 amendment. Is someone going to move that amendment? Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, that was my amendment. I don't believe I'm going to offer that amendment. There was an issue dealing with how do we deal with these people that continually don't pay their fines, continually drive speeding, recklessly endangering the public. They're going to do that whether they have a license, a valid license or a suspended license. But I think it's something that maybe we want to look at after X number of non-payment of fines over a certain time period or outstanding that have never gone to court, refused to show up in court. It's maybe something we want to look at to put a little bit of teeth back into it so those people that habitually do that end up in court.
Chair.
Chairman Lynch.
I did this for quite a few years, and I had the 10-day demand calendar quite a bit from folks who were sitting in jail, couldn't afford to make bail, and were sitting in jail on a driving after suspension. It was my job. They were entitled to a trial within 10 days on a misdemeanor, and I had to try the case. And I did. I tried those cases. And these people were writ in from Hennepin County Workhouse, Ramsey County Workhouse, Crow Wing County, Kuching County, because they were sitting there in jail on much more serious offenses. Quite frankly, in vast majority of instances, this was not even really worth their time. They were sitting in on murder. They were sitting in on kidnapping or CSC or something. If it were up to me, in the same way that Ms. Heng has stated, you know, I mean, get them on the big tamale. The percentage of the population that threaded that needle, who really didn't do anything worse than basic misdemeanor, you know, scofflaw stuff, and somehow found themselves in the still cycle. It was an extremely narrow percentage of the population. And you're right; those people irritate me too. It's extremely irritating. In fact, I had a client just like that, you know, a couple weeks ago. He paid me, though, so I was less irritated with him. But you're right. It's just that we brought this in looking at the major problems associated with those folks who aren't in that position. But I see where you're coming from.
Thank you. And members, I want to thank the careful conversation that we've had. Really plunging, you know, deep into, you know, what our intent and consequences are, and obviously we've talked about very closely related issues. And thank you, Deputy City Attorney Hang, for laying out and painting for us, you know, what the big picture is out there, not on this population, really being distinctive about what, you know, the Miss Jacksons, if you will, but also, you know, allowing us the space to talk about the other challenges that we have. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? If not, then Representative Lesch renews his motion that House File 1061 be referred to the Transportation Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesch. Thank you to the testifiers. Thank you, Ms. Jackson, Ms. Hang, and Ms. Berner. Representative Lesch, you have House File 898. And I believe the motion is to re-refer to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, that is my motion that House File 898 be referred to Ways and Means.
Very well. Your bill is before us, Representative Lesch.
So, Mr. Chair, members, hopefully you don't have to rehash. We had a lot of conversation about this, about the difficulty of getting caught in that cycle of poverty. I will tell you, in working with these gentlemen for quite a few years regarding driver diversion program, it was initially we worked with Jessica McConaughey in the St. Paul City Attorney's Office and Ms. Hang in the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office to try to find some kind of, as I referred to it, as a duct tape and baling wire method in law to try to find a way to allow these folks to get valid again. And that's what we're doing today. You know, my testifier has a lot of experience in being helpful and working well with government agencies and prosecutors' offices to make that happen. And so I would leave it in their capable hands to explain what we're doing. The bottom line is this thing has limped along for years in statute. Everyone agrees with this, that it's a good idea. And so what we want to do is make it permanent. And I don't think we have much opposition to that.
Very well. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for this time to be before you with this bill. It's a good segue from the last bill, and they all relate very well. As Chairman Lesch said, this is a program that began a long time ago in 2009 at the request of three prosecuting attorneys who noticed that 33% about of their caseloads were about people with citations for driving after suspension or driving after revocation. They came back. They said, we gotta do something about this. So they came up with a program working with DVS, some other prosecutors, law enforcement, Scott here with his Diversion Solutions program. And the program is based on three values: accountability, training, and restitution. It offers individuals an opportunity to break this cycle of repeatedly offending and earn the privilege of driving again. The program requires participants to do the following: fulfill state requirements necessary to reinstate their license, show proof of insurance to the program manager, which is Diversion Solutions, With support from program staff, they create a monthly payment plan to pay back all their fines, and they do it at a price rate that matches their income. They must take classes provided by the program manager, and they cannot have any more violations. If they do, they get kicked out of the program, and the prosecuting attorney can go forward with all the charges previously there. So what does the bill change? We are amending a law, not a statute. And that's why your bill is completely underlined. But amongst that, some is in practice now, and then there are the changes. And these are the changes. Section 1, sub 2 creates a process whereby DVS may charge a program manager $3 per applicant accepted into the program to help offset the cost of reviewing applications to the program to determine eligibility. When someone applies, they've got two people that need to give them a yes, a thumbs up. Two groups. One is DVS, and the other one is the local prosecuting attorney. They're in charge. Second, the bill would allow more people to participate in the program if DVS found them eligible and the prosecuting attorney approved. Right now, when this program started in 2009, it started in 5 cities. Today, it is in 124 cities and 15 counties. And it's only in those areas because the local prosecutors wanted the program because they had the same problems as the people that originated it. It was, their caseloads were too big, and these people kept reoffending, and there was no way to solve the problem. So the way that we do that is we cannot mandate it. We don't want to mandate it. But we want to be able to give a prosecuting attorney the ability to request an individual be reviewed by the Public Safety Department for eligibility. And second, it would allow a judge to submit a request for an individual to apply to participate. And what I mean by that is if you get a citation for DAS or DAR, and you are not in one of those 124 cities or 15 counties, you cannot go into the program. And the truth is that some people are in that position, so they find a area where there is a program, and they go up to the top and say, give me a citation so I can get into this program. So that was the way that we developed an opportunity to expand it statewide without overstepping our bounds. Section 1 sub 6, current law requires participating counties and cities to provide biennial program reports to public safety and the legislature. Section 1 sub 8 proposes that the program manager, which would be Scott, be responsible for these reports. Scott has been doing these reports for 9 years already. So we just figured, why don't we just put it in law and make it simple? And that way, if a city or a county is thinking about joining the program, they don't see that as another expense that they have to worry about. We had two amendments that we were going to add today, but the amendment did not get here. So it'll come on later in the process. One of those amendments was to add a discount on the program fee, not the fines, not the fine or fees for driving, but on the program fee. And in this case, if the citations totaled less than $250, the discount would be 60%. If the citations totaled $250 to $500, the discount would be 40%. The other portion of the amendment that we were going to offer is to strike the language having to do with ignition interlock. We were hoping that we could somehow bring those people that have the requirement to use ignition interlock into the program and give them some help and some support. But the language that we used conflicted with statute. As we vetted this bill very, very broadly, DVS said that language doesn't work. It conflicts with current law, so we're just going to pull it out and leave that for another day. I would encourage you to look at the letters that are in your packet from local prosecutors. They're very, very positive, and I think it's a good indication that this program works. In conclusion, I would say that this program helps a lot of people break the cycle and get their lives back on track. It reduces caseloads for courts and prosecutors. As of 12/31/2018, It has collected just over $9.4 million of delinquent fees and sent those back to the courts, and then the courts sent them to the appropriate entities, post board, cities, counties, et cetera. So it's really a revenue maker in that respect. And finally, it promotes public safety by increasing the number of insured drivers. It promotes judicial efficiency, and it is self-funded. Scott, as a tape, a recording that we'd like to play for you, and it's an odd thing because someone called to thank an officer for giving her a citation, but also then referring her to this program. And I think that's all the setting up you need.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Skilbred. And my understanding is that the chair will be acting on those amendments in the subsequent committees.
Very good.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Atkinson. And I did hear this tape, and it's pretty brief, and look forward to hearing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to preface it, this came to us from the Lakeville Police Department. She actually did a 911 call to thank the police department. And we've been notified already that's probably not the right use for 911. But so we did ask her to not use it again, that she can call us direct and give us all the accolades she'd like. So let's just get it started here.
Hi, Officer Jason Jensen. My name is Melissa Ellison, E-L-L-I-S-O-N. I don't know if you remember me, but you pulled me over on June 1st, 2017, and you gave me a ticket for driving without license. But not only did you give me a ticket, you gave me this orange card, and you told me to call this number to try to see if they can help me get my license. Well, I called that orange card, and sure enough, they are able to help me get my license. I will be getting my license back this week. I just want to say thank you so much. I cannot thank you enough. I am so grateful to you. Thank you so much. I have been pulled over a few times, and nobody never told me about this program. So I just want to say thank you so much. Even though you gave me a ticket, you was able to help me at the same time. And I just want to say thank you for being the best officer ever. Jason, thank you. Have yourself a good day. Bye-bye.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson. It goes to the, I think, some kind of an old saying about, you know when there's a good law where folks can be held accountable and totally respected and be grateful for the application of the law.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? I'm sorry. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
First of all, I want to say I support these diversion programs. They work well. We have not only this one, but a couple different things that the state has allowed from besides the diversion programs, getting the program fixed so we can use them again. I believe that's what this bill does. But I'm just wondering what the path is for this bill. I know it's going to Ways and Means. Do you know where it's supposed to go or intended to? Next committee stop is?
It's a good question, Representative Johnson. Representative Lesh, my understanding is that this is going to move to transportation and then back to your committee. Does that sound like a plan?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very well. And obviously you'll have an opportunity to work on those amendments in one or both of those committees. Very well. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Then if not, Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 898 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesh. And Mr. Atkinson and Mr. Skilbred, for putting forward a good bill for us to consider. Members and Representative Lesh, we do have two bills left. We're not going to be able to complete those inside of the 7 or so minutes that we have. And so, we're going to recess a little bit early. Don't use up all those minutes in one place now. We'll plan to see you all back, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, since we are reconvening this committee until, was it 5 p.m. to room 300 South, last week we ran out of time and adjourned after a number of proponents had testified on House File 741, and no opponents to this bill were had an opportunity to testify. We had a number of our members wanting to ask some questions of the testifiers, and I'm just wondering if you could do your best to try to get those testifiers we have heard back here so our members of this committee have an opportunity to ask the questions they had. I know we had a list going at one time. We had not completed that list. But I'd like to have all the members have an opportunity to ask the questions they had and make sure that they can ask the right person.
Representative Johnson, it's absolutely appropriate for committee members to make sure that we and all of us have an opportunity to question testifiers and have a full debate. There were quite a few questions that were asked by quite a few members on the bill that Representative Noor had before us, House File 741. We certainly will make our effort, good effort, to make sure that those who were here last week can return, and we absolutely intend to hear from those who had come expressing concern with the bill. So members, that's true. We did offer to extend the time as well because we didn't have a committee meeting here as we typically have. And my big friends on the other side of the aisle demurred on extending the time. So members, I will certainly be working awfully hard to make sure that we all get to participate. That is a two-way street. So with that, we're going to stand in recess until 5 p.m., and we will reconvene in room 300 South. Certainly be watching your emails in the event that there's any update to any of that, but I do not expect that. So we, this committee stands in recess. All right, we will reconvene the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform. And first bill, we've got two bills this evening, House File 628 and House File 741. We're going to start with 628, Chairman Lesh. And Chairman Lesh, your motion is to move House File 628 to be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
That's right? Yeah? Okay, so Representative Lesh so moves, and the bill is before us.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, members. This is Senator Lass's bill in the Senate. He sent it over to me. It would provide for a return of a vehicle proposed for forfeiture after DWI arrest if the owner agrees to install an ignition interlock device on the vehicle. So one of the principles of forfeiture, fruit of which we're dealing with and have been dealing with in this committee for years, because of how it's been conducted in certain ways, is that it would keep the roads safer because we wouldn't have drunk drivers on the road. Well, with the advent of the interlock system, we have the ability to not take cars, which are many people's greatest asset, away from them and ensure that they're not putting anyone in danger on the road by driving because they have an interlock system. So this bill was heard last year and passed in the Senate. A forfeiture of a vehicle takes place after repeated DWIs. So there's one instance where it can occur. It's essentially you can forfeit after second degree. So second degree is predicated on either two priors in 10 years or a prior and blowing over a .16 or prior and having a kid younger than 16 in the car, any combination of those three. So in 15 years of prosecution, I don't think I saw a first-time second degree, but this week one came across my desk just now where a woman blew over a 1.6 and had a kid in the car. But that doesn't happen that often. Generally, it's repeated DWIs. So this is, it's characterized as remedial action used for the purpose of protecting public safety. So I've not seen a claim that forfeiting a vehicle really protects the public. It's only to get them to not drive. Now we have the interlock system. So the principle is that if you agree to have interlock installed on your vehicle, that forfeiture, which this committee has dealt with and wrestled with for years, would not be something that you can do. So with this bill, you'd have licensed, insured people driving lawfully and not under the influence. If an individual loses a vehicle, they'll likely have their credit ruined. This makes it even harder for them to recover financially. Having poor finances, no way to work, and bad credit doesn't set up a likely scenario for someone to actually move past their alcohol problem, get help, and drive safe on the road. So this, obviously, having a vehicle also helps you get treatment. So, members, different agencies throughout the state have different philosophies with respect to forfeiture. I know about 10 years ago, the St. Paul City Attorney Office stepped in because it was not seen as helpful. And, of course, many of these forfeitures were conducted on vehicles that there's no way that the forfeiture, the cost of the vehicle, and auctioning it off would pay for the costs associated with the prosecution and the forfeiture. It just wouldn't happen. Now, there are some people who absolutely believe that by taking cars away from poor people, we're going to make the roads safer. And I can't change their mind about that. I think that the interlock system, which is also advocated by many of these same folks, does substantially more to promote public safety than does a forfeiture system, which in many cases, the DWI forfeitures notwithstanding, in many cases has been abused over the course of the last 15 years that I've served in this body. So that's the basis behind this. It was Senator Latz's idea. Senator Latz also was the one who, I think it was when he was originally in the House, pushed for the interlock system. This was around about 10 years ago. He pushed for it and authored much of the original legislation, and I think saw the idea now that because it's in wide use, that the idea of taking cars away from people who can't afford to have their only means of transportation and livelihood taken away, we don't need to do that. I would also put on the table, members, that I have my reservations about the interlock system. Prior to that, we had B-card. You know, we still have. I mean, these are systems administered by the government, a work permit, B-card, what have you. And you had due process related to that of what went on. The interlock system is a private system run by a private industry, and it is required by law that government shuttles you off to a private industry to do that. And even though I have supported it, I still kind of have some reservations about this because government is on the hook for saying what an individual has to do or can't do, and yet we're not accountable for it because we shuttle them off to a private system. So I say this advocating for the interlock system being a good system and a good alternative that we've had for the past 10 years, but have reservations about government shirking the responsibilities that it started through due process. So I would leave it at that and stand for questions. I'm assuming there are some testifiers.
And thank you, Representative Lesh. Do you have testifiers on behalf of your bill?
I don't think so, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Chair Lesh. I got a couple different questions. First of all, I'm just wondering, Representative O'Neill has another bill that's traveling through that requires anybody on their second DWI to be involved in the interlock system. How will this affect that bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't think it will. I mean, to the extent that, second DWI is only a second degree if you have that additional enhancing factor. So to the extent that someone, Representative O'Neill's bill simply requires interlock. This says that if you voluntarily accept interlock and go with interlock, that they can't forfeit your car. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Chair Mariani, Chair Lesh. That's a little bit of my point, is the fact that more than likely we're going to be requiring them to do the interlock, so there wouldn't be any voluntary choice. If they don't do the interlock, they don't really have a choice in not to do it, so it'd make the forfeit. So this bill wouldn't be any forfeitures at all then, because they would be required to do the interlock either way. But the other concern I have with, main concern I have with this bill is, reading through it, all the person has to do is voluntarily participate. If they want to save their vehicle, I think they should have to actually complete the interlock course. This doesn't say anything about completing it. They can start it, stop the process, then drop out of it. I think we need to tighten it up to make sure that they actually have to complete the course.
Mr. Chair and Chair Johnson, I'm open to amendment. I didn't see one drafted, but I don't think that'd be a terrible idea. I would say this though, members, I'm not one who believes that interlock is a good, or I'm sorry, interlock, that forfeiture is a good in itself. Forfeiture is there to deter bad conduct or to ensure public safety. So if the roads are safe because folks can't drive without an interlock, whether it's voluntary or involuntary, and we're not doing forfeitures, I think that's a win-win.
Representative Grasso. Oh, I'm sorry. I jumped over Representative Adelson, then Representative Grasso.
I was I'm not used to this room.
It's kind of weird.
It is, yes. Chair, Representative Lesh, I signed on to Representative O'Neill's bill. I think it's a good one. I will just note that the interlock system that is from Edina. Again, to the people that created that, I'm very proud of that. Anytime I can plug Edina, I will. Yes. I have a real... I think that, when we look at Edina, we have a lot of people that come through and they're drinking and driving on Highway 100. It's a big problem, which is why I really like Representative O'Neill's bill. But I think that in terms of forfeiture, I think that this is a good bill in terms of making sure if we forfeit or if somebody loses their license or anything, we know that they're still driving, right? So we have to try to get to the real root of, what's going to happen here. So I do appreciate your thoughts on that, too. So I just want to see this successful for us to try to get people off the roads that are drinking and driving.
Thank you, Representative Adelson. Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do have members. We do have someone from the public who's going to testify. I believe opposed to the bill. It's Chief Pate from Shakopee. And, sir, I apologize that we kept you around all day. Didn't think that through earlier, but really appreciate your presence. So perhaps after this question, we can have the chief.
A short question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Lesh, earlier with Representative Pinto's bill, Chiefs of Police Association, Sheriff's Association, State Patrol, how do they stand on this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Grossel, Chair just said that there's a chief here coming to testify in opposition. And in my experience, the chiefs have opposed almost every effort for forfeiture reform. Well, actually, no, every effort for forfeiture reform that we've had.
That's okay. We're okay.
So if I'm gonna go to Vegas and put some money down on the roulette wheel, I'm gonna say they're gonna be again it. but we'll see. Who knows? Maybe they actually are.
Mr. Grossel, perhaps might be a good time to ask the chief to come forward.
Yeah, sure.
That would be
further questions.
Have further testimony from the other associations. I'd like to know where they weigh in on this.
We'll see if they're here to do that. Absolutely. Chief Tate, welcome back. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jeff Tate,
Chief of Police for the City of Shakopee, and I'm with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I would like to point out, too, that I know Mr. Bernstein from the DWI Task Force wants to testify on this bill as well.
Thank you.
I'm here representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We represent over 300 chiefs throughout the state of Minnesota. Our Chiefs Association does oppose House File 628. While we recognize ignition interlock is a helpful tool, it is not the only tool, nor, as studies show, is it always the most effective option. We strongly believe in forfeitures, which play a vital role in keeping our roads safe, and it is imperative that ignition interlock and forfeitures remain options for us moving forward. We respectfully oppose this bill for several reasons. The first has been brought up already, and that is it does not address what happens if ignition interlock is removed from the vehicle, whether the owner leaves the program or fails out of it. They just have to be a participant. The state's own study on ignition interlock shows that most people don't complete the program. Only 48% of those studied actually completed the program. The vast majority of those who completed the program were first-time offenders with low blood alcohol concentrations. The forfeiture process would not apply to those individuals at all. Interlock is much less successful with repeat offenders who have high blood alcohol tests or refuse the test. Additionally, those ordered into the interlock during the state study, only 40% enrolled. I'm quoting the state study directly. The more severe the DWI violation at the time of arrest, the less likely the driver is to complete the program. People who blew a .16 or higher were 40.4% less likely to complete the program than those who blew under a 1.6, and 58.7% more likely to reoffend. People who refused the test were 50.8% less likely to complete the program, and 124.5% more likely to be arrested again after completion. The more prior offenses one has, the more likely they won't complete the program. For example, 2 and 10 years, you're at 56.9% less likely to complete. Your 4th and 10 years, you are 95.4% less likely to complete the program. Also, people whose enrollments were extended or started over are less likely to complete the program. This is why we need both options. Where interlock is at its weakest, we have forfeiture in place. I'd also like to point out another scientific study that was recently done from 2017 out of the University of Maryland. The study examined the effectiveness of ignition interlock, including recidivism rates. The study agreed with the Minnesota study that while people were on ignition interlock, recidivism rates were lower, crashes were lower. However, concluded, and I quote, upon removal, the risk of both citations and crashes is higher for those who had interlock devices installed. And ignition interlock devices are effective for the time they are used, but should not be the only tool to prevent events of alcohol-involved driving among those previously arrested for impaired driving. One more study from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine examined 14 previous studies on ignition interlock. Once a participant was removed from the interlock program, their recidivism rates were that of the control group. These findings suggest that the experience of being enrolled in an ignition interlock program by itself does not generally lead to long-term changes in the propensity to drink and drive that last beyond the period of ignition interlock installation. So does forfeiture work? In Scott County, we did a study. We looked back 7 years. We examined every single vehicle in Scott County and the city of Bemidji because we wanted to look at a city outside of the metro. And this includes the state patrol. Every vehicle that was successfully forfeited going back 7 years, we took those 5 years and we looked at the recidivism rate. The minimum time that somebody had to reoffend was 2 years, which is often what most interlock studies are, 1 or 2 years. We gave them 5. The recidivism rate for our group was 16.2%. I think that's fantastic. I think that shows that forfeitures do work. We are taking the weapon out of their hands. And I use that term weapon for a reason. We heard that cars are their greatest asset, and taking vehicles away hurts credit. I think lost in this conversation seems to be the victims in this. Innocent drivers on the road. I would like to point out the victims are always made whole before forfeiture funds are dispersed. These are individuals who are typically on strike three, strike four. I can think of one case in our jurisdiction right now where our forfeiture proceeds will be somewhere around $1,000. Every dime of that is going to a victim. I think the bill also creates a lot of problems in terms of staffing issues, where the interlocks are going to be installed. I believe there is one interlock company that can do that in your tow yard. Are we supposed to have an officer at every single tow yard watching the installation of this? The administration of this is very would be very, very problematic for law enforcement agencies. So, Mr. Chair, members, again, we believe in interlock, but it clearly has limitations. We join the state's DWI task force and MAD Minnesota in respectfully opposing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Tate. Representative Lesser?
Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Fassada.
Chief, how many people died at the hands of drunk drivers last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative, right off the top of my head, I do not
ballpark
know.
Ballpark figure?
I would hate to guess right now. I'm sorry, I just don't know that right off the top of my head.
Last time, thank you, Mr. Chair. Last time I knew it was about 39,000 a year. In 2 years, we lose more people than we lost in Vietnam. This is, and we are, frankly, when you compare every other industrial country's response to DWI, we are by far the most lenient. I'm really struggling with that. I probably will vote to support this bill so we can go forward with it, but I got some real problems with it. And to be honest, my feeling is straight punitive. The victims of the people that are killed by these people, and I've known a couple. That's enough, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, that's why I use the term weapon. We take the weapon out of their hands. We have a victim advocate that is in-house at the Shakopee Police Department, and I can tell you that victims are surprised that we can take the vehicle away, and there is some solace there. There is some satisfaction from a victim's perspective that at least that person's vehicle is being taken away. Might they go buy another vehicle or have someone buy it? Typically, they'd put it in somebody else's name. That happens.
Representative Baldwin.
Thanks. I had some concerns about this bill, too, but I'm just curious for purposes of reparations, if victims of drunk driving incidents, do they qualify for money from the reparations board in an effort to help make them whole?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand that they do.
Okay, thank you. And that's separate from the forfeiture funds, then that would be, or Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I had another question.
Well, I was too busy chewing.
Sorry.
Your name.
And that's separate from the forfeiture money that you were talking about being provided to the victims?
Chief Tate. Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill. And then we do have another testifier, is that correct? So after this question, we'll bring up the other testifier. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to answer the question really quick about fatalities, I was just looking at our state website, Department of Transportation, and it was the total fatalities for 17, which is the most recent we have, is 358 of that, 72 were from drunk driving. And I would note that 25 were from distracted driving, as we're doing a lot of legislation around distracted driving. This was part of this, I believe, was in the bill when I first started with the ignition interlock and was removed. I do appreciate what Chair Johnson had to say about completion. You know, I think that's a really good component. And I would just ask, you know, if we made those changes, would the association be more amenable to supporting it? You know, if we said, well, you know, you actually have to complete ignition interlock, not just start it, has that conversation come up?
Chief Tate, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our association's position in the past has been we support ignition interlock, all fender interlock, but not at the expense of forfeiture.
Okay, thank you. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, no matter how this is drafted, if it's just
about forfeiture period, then there's not support. I think the only forfeiture bill that was enacted in law in the last 20 years or something was the one that I had, and it was just standing in court for like the spouse of someone that had the vehicle forfeited. I know that this is something that it's contentious on both sides, so I just wanted to see kind of where you would stand. So again, it's no forfeiture. You wouldn't support any forfeiture bill, no matter how it's written, other than the one that was signed into law a couple years ago.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess we would have to see what a final bill look like. I think there's other, again, I highlighted some other issues that this bill creates problematic in terms of the overall administration of it. Okay. Forfeitures are a lot of work. They're a lot of work. As Representative Lesh said, you know, departments do it differently because it takes a lot of resources and a lot of time to do forfeitures, and not every department has that. And if we start having some of this role, it would be difficult for some departments to administer this.
Chief Tate, I'm wondering if, along Representative O'Neill's questions, and I get the official position of the, you know, the association, and so I understand you're following that honestly and transparently through us. But I'm wondering if, to your knowledge, has the association have had the opportunity to have this conversation relative to the kind of idea that Representative Johnson pointed out here? Or is that a new element that hasn't been talked about at this point?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any conversation that we've had as an association in terms of working to craft this legislation, this specific piece, and any to tighten it up, I guess, would probably be the term I would use.
That's fair. With that, members, I'm going to ask Mr. Bernstein to come forward. And, Chief, if you can hang around
sure.
just for a little bit more,
sure.
Because there may be some more questions for you. And thank you, sir, for staying here this today to work with us on this. Mr. Bernstein, if you can give us, state your name and your testimony. And we do have two other questions that that are in line here from Representative Dean and Representative Johnson. They may be to you, but they may also be to the Chief. But if you can also hang around, we'll just keep things moving. Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is David Bernstein. I'm the Chair of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. I testified on this bill, a companion bill in the Senate last week, and my comments here will be the same. Respectfully, the DWI Task Force has voted to oppose House File 628 as written, and that's because of some of the concerns in the language of the bill. The goal of this bill is to promote public safety, but the application of the bill as written fails to do that. The largest concern that the task force has was pointed out by Representative Johnson, and the state, the task force would want an amendment indicating that the offender would need to enter into and successfully complete the ignition interlock program. In addition to that, though, if someone does not complete the ignition interlock program, there should be an indication that the ignition interlock provider needs to contact law enforcement. Otherwise, law enforcement would have no indication that the person did not complete that. There are other concerns as well. For example, in line 1.13 of the bill, it indicates if the person subsequently operates the motor vehicle to commit a designated offense. And there was ambiguity as to what is considered a designated offense, which would indicate that the vehicle would be seized and summarily forfeited. So the task force believes that designated offense needs to be defined explicitly. In addition, in line 1.14, the bill indicates that the vehicle must be seized and summarily forfeited. The question becomes by whom, especially when we're talking about different jurisdictions enforcing this provision. Take an example of if a vehicle is forfeited and the DWI occurs in the city of Minneapolis. The Minneapolis Police Department makes the arrest and issues the impoundment order. If the person is found committing, let's say, a tampering with the ignition interlock violation in St. Paul, and the St. Paul police make a stop, does the St. Paul Police Department have the authority to impound that vehicle, or is that vehicle with the Minneapolis Police Department? Is the original impoundment order stayed, or is it rescinded when the offender enters into the ignition interlock program? And if the person fails out or commits a new offense, is that original impoundment order then put back in place, or is a new impoundment order required? These are legal due process requirements that need to be addressed. There was a case at the Court of Appeals issued this past summer called Olson. The legal citation is 910 Northwest 2nd 72. It's currently up for review at the Minnesota Supreme Court. In that case, the Court of Appeals ruled that due process is required of forfeiture proceedings. And so when it comes to enforcing the impoundment order, the authority to enforce that order needs to be established in the bill. Is that done by the police, or is there judicial oversight? And the Olson case seems to indicate that judicial oversight is necessary. The DWO task force believes that that's something that needs to be addressed in this bill for due process concerns to be satisfied. Lastly, there are members of the DWI task force that are working for the Public Defender's Office, and they brought up a concern that in order to get installed ignition interlock at the impound lot, it requires mobile installation. And one of the ignition interlock providers is a member of the task force as well. They indicated to us that mobile installation is an increased cost, and while ignition interlock vendors are required to accept a certain number of indigent individuals, mobile installation is not covered by the indigency funds, by that grant for ignition interlock. So that essentially prices out innocent individuals from installing the ignition interlock, which also presents an equal protection concern. And so the public defenders did voice that concern to me as well. For these reasons, the DWI task force opposes House File 628 as written, anticipating what Representative O'Neill discussed earlier. If we were to see amendments or changes in the language, the DWI task force is open to changing its position. But as written, there are too many problems with the practical application of this bill. Thank you.
Very well. We do have a couple more. Thank you, Mr. President. And we do have a couple questions, more than a couple. Representative Dean, and then back to you, Representative Johnson.
A couple comments and then a question. You know, the example you gave of if a car with a ignition interlock is stopped in St. Paul, and my head just starts spinning. I thought the whole idea of the ignition interlock was for that not happen. But I know that there are people that find ways around many, many things. But my larger question is, so what are sort of other consequences beyond forfeiture that are currently in statute for individuals? Because it seems like we probably have some other things, and personally, I'm not a big fan of forfeiture. I think that it sometimes creates lots more difficulties for individuals than rather not. As you were talking about the mobile installation costing more, I begin to think, well, should this be going through commerce? But we don't want it to go through another committee because it needs to go back to judicial. So what about other types of consequences in statute beyond just forfeiture? Can you speak to that, either the author or the testifier?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, you're asking, are there other consequences of a DWI?
In statute. Pardon me, Mr. Chair, Chair Lesh. I'm not talking about increased insurance and all those other types of things, but other consequences in statute.
Well, Ms. Chair and Representative Dean, yes. I mean, there's a laundry list. I mean, depending on what you're talking about, I mean, you've got, depending on what level, you're up to a felony of doing state prison time for it. I know you know that. There are fines. There are your evaluation, chemical dependency evaluation, complying with all the results of that. There's your MAD panel. There's your court fee. On the civil side, there's your license revocation, and we're not even talking about those others in statute that involve having to pay, you know, attorneys and that other business in there. But people are dealing with license revocation and plate revocation at the same time, too, fighting the attorney general on that. Outside of felony, I don't know another area of law that has as much of a complicated series of hoops and flowchart you have to do than DWI law. So yes, there are a glut of consequences. You know, I will say this, Ms. Chair and Representative Dean, the issue that this is aimed at is the forfeiture question. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand it, I get it. You know, the prosecutors and the police, they're between a rock and a hard place because they get funded by this. And, you know, it is what it is. They don't want to lose funding. You know, last year when we had Representative Knobloch as the Ways and Means Chair having the forfeiture bill. It was awesome because you could have said, hey, you know, make them whole. cover law enforcement with those costs that they're now getting from forfeiting your car because you're essentially telling them. I mean, I don't know too many people who would suggest to you that policing and prosecuting by taking the proceeds and assets of an individual to pay for your costs is a great way to do business. It's a terrible way to do business. Terrible. And I don't know, I've never met a person who told me otherwise. That said, we have the very real problem of trying to make them whole. So it would have been nice if, you know, we would have gotten that through with Chair of the Ways and Means, and he could have made them whole at the same time when we did away with this kind of like what I consider to be a bad system for this. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole glut of consequences for folks out there for DWI.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair D. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members. Representative Lesh brought up the issue of the last session with the Chair Ways and Means having the bill. And I had an uncomfortable situation talking to him about it. But one thing, this has always been a tough issue to deal with. And one thing, even before I was chair, when Representative Cornish was chair, and I believe it was when Representative Hillstrom was chair, part of it. One of the requirements when we dealt with forfeiture is all parties had to sit down and agree on things. Unfortunately, that hasn't been done at this time. So it's a very difficult decision. For me, I have no problem doing the forfeitures with people who drink and get the multiple DWIs. I've been to the crashes. I've had to knock on doors and tell parents that their children are not coming home. So I have no problem with the forfeitures.
Senator Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and a question for Mr. Bernstein. Some of the cost issues concerning ignition interlock are concerning to me as well, and I've actually heard from a constituent who's had a number of breakdowns and malfunctions and a lot of extra fees that he simply can't afford. With that, so I appreciated your comments about that. My question for you, though, has to do with your comments about some ambiguity in the law, and you said one of them is what is a designated offense. And I'm looking at this statute, 169A63, and it's my understanding that designated offenses specifically are defined in Subdivision 1 of that statute. So am I incorrect about that? I think it's already defined elsewhere in the statute, so I don't think it would need a separate definition here unless I'm wrong about that.
Mr. Bernstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I would need to look at that statute to I'm sure what you're saying is correct. I have been approached by law enforcement saying there's a lot of confusion, so perhaps law enforcement isn't aware of that statute, but I can certainly take a look at it and make sure that it encompasses everything that we feel it should.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd appreciate that, and I'm just referring to this statute that this is amending, and it's Subdivision 1, just for the record. And then my other comment or question perhaps is for the chief. And I'm just wondering, some of the studies and the statistics you cited, that would be really useful for me to see. And I'm new, so if there was some report that came out that other people know about, I haven't seen that, and I would find that information really helpful if there was some kind of report or something that you could provide for us.
So it's not a question for
it's you? Not, well, I'm hoping he's willing to do that. I'm seeing a head nodding, and that's satisfactory to me, if that works.
The record reflect that the chief has nodded his head affirmatively. We did bring another chair up, just in case Chief wants to join us at the table. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for pointing out. I could have looked that up on the smartphone, which I did, and it was just under 11,000 people died in 2018. It was 37,000 plus that died total. So I just wanted to correct what I had said.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Representative O'Neill? Oh, we're good? Okay. So Representative Lesh, I'm hearing a couple of ideas here, and I think you indicated earlier that you were very early, that you were very amenable to, or interested, I think. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I just want to figure out how to continue moving forward with this bill. I know it's got to move
to, if it moves, it needs to move to a couple of other committees. I think you had expressed some desire to be very open about doing some amendments here. I'm wondering if you could provide us some guidance in terms of
Mr. Chair.
We should proceed at this
point. Mr. Chair, so I know the current status of this has been, it has the support of Senate Judiciary, I think the chair over there, the lead, and then a few other folks, so it's, the skids are greased in the Senate on it. You know, the thoughts that were brought up here, I guess if language was offered, because I, you know, I can't agree to language that I haven't seen, if language was offered that would allow them to you know, not oppose it, and I'm sure they'll have heartburn over it, because I think there's a fundamental disagreement over the philosophy of forfeiture, Mr. Chair. And I don't think that's going to go away this session. It just is what it is. But to the extent that, that this can be worked out, yes, I'd entertain language, and I'd, you know, look at maybe we can even lay it over now, and that language can be presented to me, because this is, no one spoke to me before tonight about this, and then if that's based upon the two items that would that were said that, you know, would make this bill less objectionable, you know, if that would work for them. Bring that back, and we'll see if we can offer the amendments.
Very well. So again, you know, it speaks to the quality of the conversation and deliberation in this committee. And so with that, then, let me just say, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. So with that, I believe, Representative Lesh, you would then modify your motion that the House file, and get the right number, 628, be laid over. And then that'll give you an opportunity and others to look over some amended language, and we'll bring this bill back up, hopefully, and then act on it in the near future.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would ask that they bring that language to me, though, because I, again, you know, I'm, if I make it up, you know, it'll be a little back and forth, so... They can bring
I think
to
your
me.
Message is being sent forcefully to our fellow citizens here. So with that, so the motion is to lay House File 628 over, and we'll bring it up as soon as possible.
Okay.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Lay over.
Well,
we could do that.
The chair lies, please, House File 628 over.
Thank you, gentlemen, Mr. Bernstein. Chief, okay, thank you. All right, with that, we do have the last bill, House File 741, Representative Doar. And Representative Dean, I believe you made the motion last time, and then we lay this over, so we don't need a new motion. All right, very well. So we're working off of the D motion to re-refer House File.
We tabled it. We need to take it up.
You tabled it, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you. Representative Dean, do you have a motion for me then?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that we
Judiciary.
Take House File 741 up table and refer to Judiciary.
Thank you, Representative Dean, and thank you, Representative Nash, for the reminder. House File 741 is before us. Representative Doar, you had some very strong testimony and some excellent at the last meeting. And we've spoken. I know that you've extended an invitation to your testifiers that were present on behalf of the bill last time to also be present here today. And I do see a few that are, just because I know some members had asked if that could be possible for some table questioning. I think what would be appropriate at this point, however, members, would be, because we did not hear from folks in the public who had concerns with the bill, and I think it's appropriate that we offer that opportunity at this time, and then we'll move into questions for both groups. So if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in House File 741, please come forward.
I'm not against the bill.
Why don't we take the opposing?
Yep, that's fine.
And then we'll come back to you if that's okay. Please come forward, sir. and give us your name and testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I have a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm appearing before you today on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition for Bettered Women.
Good to see you, Mr. Carlson. I don't think I've ever chaired where you've been the testifier. We've been here together for a number of years.
It's never happened before. Mr. Chair, members, it's been a long time since I've had a hearing in room 300.
Yes.
So,
yeah,
it
might be a long time before.
This is where they used to, in the old days, this is where they used to put us when you really had to get a bill done and get it out of here. So, Mr. Chair, members, on behalf of the MCBW, don't want to express opposition to the bill on its face, but I want to point out a couple of issues that we would like the committee to consider as this bill advances. And just as a reminder, we've worked on bail issues on behalf of battered women for many times, and what can happen when unintended consequences that can happen. I'll give you just one example. The legislature at one point said you could not impose conditions on release when you imposed maximum bail. And that happened in a case about 7 years ago. And the court let a gentleman out. His name was Stephen Van Kern, and they let him out with maximum bail, and he went on to kill his former partner, Terry Lee, and her boyfriend, Tim Hankinson, while her children hid in the closet. And our concern with the bill in front of you isn't that we want to keep people needlessly in jail. That's certainly not it. But we would like you to look at the language so that we're clear that we don't have the unintended consequences that we've had with bail decisions in the past. If you look at the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm going to refer to just a couple of specific points. If on lines 1.12, the legislation deals with release of a defendant who's charged with a misdemeanor offense, and one of our concerns is that you may be arrested or detained for a violent assault, but you're ultimately charged with disorderly conduct. And we need to have the discretion in the language that that allows someone who's arrested for a violent offense but may be charged with a lesser offense to be treated seriously with the court on their conditions of release. You also know on lines 1.14 that the grounds that you're talking about here are limited to the defendant's ability to appear at court. And there are other issues that maybe are involved here rather than just your ability to appear in court. And so, we'd like you to consider that there are safety issues. If your likelihood to appear is the only condition that you can look at, and not the safety of someone who maybe was involved in an altercation with you, we just think that you're limiting judicial discretion in a way that may have unintended consequences. And you'll see that, you know, that the defendant's ability to appear is pretty much the consistent touchstone of this legislation. And you don't get to the safety of the victim at all, in our estimation, and I don't think that's intended. But when you look at the judge's discretion, you will notice that on page 2.19, that the discretion is limited to endangering the public safety. Well, I would view the public safety as a danger to Mr. Hultquist here or someone at large. And it is not limited to danger to a defendant, or excuse me, to a victim. And that is, I think, a potential unintended consequence here where the judge would have to find a public safety risk as opposed to someone on the street, as opposed to tying that to a victim who maybe was involved with an assault that is charged out as a disorderly conduct, as an example. So I think these are fixable problems. We don't want to have people needlessly being detained in jail because they can't post bail. That's certainly not our intent. But we don't want to have unintended consequences that can create difficult situations for victims. And we know that one of the most lethal times for a victim of domestic violence is at the time of release or at the time of making a complaint. So please keep those in mind as you consider this important legislation, but we want to make sure there are no unintended consequences. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Carlson or myself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson, we've been working a lot on issues with Coalition Bettered Women, so thank you. As I
as I understand the structure of the bill as it's intended, the thought is that the concern about safety, whether the public or somebody else, is addressed in pulling out these offenses that do pose a public safety risk. And I see your point that somebody may be charged with disorderly conduct arrest on something more serious. If that point is addressed, where it's based on the arrest rather than the charge, does that lessen your concern? Because I guess the concern that I would have back is that if you simply have this blanket comment about safety, that then potentially pulls this back into allowing as much discretion as there is right now and kind of undermining what I understand the author's intent.
Can
you just sort of comment on
the point that I made? Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 points, Representative Pinto. I think if you look at the language on the presumption on release on personal recognizance, or there's one other passage in the bill, and I don't have it marked. If you add language that gives the discretion related to a victim's safety or will endanger the public safety, that gives us some comfort. I will caution you, though, that part of the concern, and you've added a couple more crimes with the A2 amendment, anytime you make a Noah's Ark list of everything that's included, you're going to miss something. And that is problematic. When I was looking up 609.224.2 that you added, 609.2241 is a misdemeanor spreading of a communicable disease, which isn't included, but it's a horrible thing. And if I had somebody in court that I wanted to hold, I'd have to find some other reason to do it. So I'm just worried that you create a list of crimes and you're going to, by inadvertence, we're going to miss something. And so that's where I think, as you get to the discretion of the court to find for a victim's safety or public safety, that it isn't just tied to their being able to reappear in court. That's the concern that I raise.
And then just one
other thing. So it helps, yes.
It does. That would help. Yeah. And then my question, Mr. Chair, is just going back to line 2.19, I guess it would not occur to me, and I just want to press you just ever since later, Mr. Carlson, that the term endanger the public safety would not encompass a specific victim as well. I guess I would not have even thought to read it that way. So I guess I just kind of want to press just one notch further on that. Say, it's really your view in looking at that public safety would somehow be right to exclude the safety of an individual victim?
Correct. Mr. Chairman and Representative Pinto, that is exactly our concern. Exactly.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Long. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask a similar question to Representative Pinto, but I'll just ask a follow-up to him, which is, do you have examples in statute or case law of where public safety has been read to not include the safety of a victim, who I think would be fairly considered a member of the public?
Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chairman, Representative Long, I know we had a lengthy debate last year about the destruction of public property and infrastructure that went through a long history of endangering the public safety that didn't endanger a specific individual. So I don't want to underplay our concern about the language that, although we enumerate a few crimes, this bill doesn't say that one of the issues for the court to consider is the safety of a victim or a potential victim. It does just doesn't say it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just as an example, I carried a Minnesota Coalition for Better Women bill 2 or 3 years ago where we left off domestic assault by strangulation in consideration for custody. And judges were literally not considering if that had occurred, that was a consideration with custody. And so we had to add it back into the list, just as the testifier had stated, that you wouldn't think you would have to do that, but because we were so prescriptive, we actually had to add it back in the list of domestic assault by strangulation. So I actually really understand this concern because we've had to amend statute just because of it. So it is a real concern, and thank you for pointing that out.
Mr. Chairman, we're more than happy to work with Representative Knorr to get this language in the condition that we all, I think, intended to be in. We're just not convinced it's quite there yet.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, as I'm thinking about what you're talking about, I'm thinking about the case that does get pleaded down currently to disorderly conduct or something like that. And in the current situation, a cash bail would be set that would be X amount of dollars. And I don't know what the percentage of individuals that are in the situation can actually afford a cash bail, if it would be large or not. And I would hope that the courts would take into consideration what the original offense may have been as something gets pleaded down. So I guess my question to you, and I appreciate that you're willing to try to clarify language, and I assume the intent of the clarification is for the courts as they consider this situation where we do it with cash bail. But it almost seems like there's already an imbalance in the system for wealthy individuals relative to poor individuals. And I would never want to say that, you know, protecting victims of, you know, domestic assault don't need protected at all ends of the spectrum. But I'm wondering if you might speak to that issue, and maybe there's even a way to change this language so there's a lot more clarity that even with some cash bail, with some cases, that the courts need to be really, really clear around these issues, because it seems like there's a lot open to interpretation right now, and I think your goal is to close that interpretation, if you could speak to that.
And
Mr. Carnes.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean, I think you kind of hit my problem right on the head. And if you look at lines 1.20 and 1.21, it's as if the court sets money bail without other conditions on which it must also set money bail without other conditions on which the defendant may be released. And I'm more interested in the conditions on release than I am about the $100. That's what I want to make sure that we preserve the discretion on. And that's, you know, that's where I think there's a safety issue here. I can impose bail or conditions on release with the addition of violation of an order for protection, which was in the amendment. But it doesn't say I can impose an order for protection as a condition of release. I just don't see it in here. I'm not saying that that's intended. I don't see it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just hope that as this bill moves forward, that we continue to do work, and with this next stop, hopefully we can get some of these things ironed out through an amendment process.
Mr. Johnson, I think you have quite a few more questions.
Members, there's a question before the body about setting bail with no conditions of release. I've heard that a few times. I just want to offer the clarification that that's a constitutional requirement from the Minnesota Constitution. The Minnesota Constitution guarantees that all persons before conviction shall be bailable by sufficient sureties, except for capital offenses, and we no longer have capital offenses. So the situation where someone is being released on bail only is a constitutional requirement, and that language that is in the bill comes actually directly currently from Rule 6.02 of the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, which is what the courts are applying now.
Mr. Johnson, why don't you stay at the table for a bit, and then we do have four other questions. We do have four other questions, including one other testifier as well. I hadn't forgotten about you, so I want to make sure we get you. If the time starts looking bad for you, just give me a signal. All right, why don't you come forward, and I do have questions. I do have four questions for members, but I want to make sure that this citizen can get her two cents in, and then move forward with other things she needs
okay.
to do.
So thank you very much. My name is Tanya Hunsey. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Freedom Fund. We're a community bail fund that is bailing people out of jail for misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor offenses. We work primarily in Hennepin County. And I just really wanted to be able to give you guys a full picture of what we've been doing. We've been around since 2016. It started out with a grad student, a project that he started. In 2018, we really started building on that. And from June of 2018 until December of 2018, we bailed out 127 people on criminal bails in Hennepin County. The majority of those, we have an average, so we do up to $1,000 bail because that only the majority of the time, that's not including a felony offense, that's a much higher bail, and so we only do misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. The average bail that we're paying is $245. The majority of the time that I'm paying bail, it's $78. About a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, I paid a $35 bail for a gentleman. About 95% of the people that we're bailing out are people of color. They're all in poverty. We have gotten emails and testimony from some of the clients that we've bailed out on how we've kept them from being homeless, that we have kept them from losing their job, that they would have lost custody to their kids because they would not be able to be out there and out in the free world to be a part of that. It costs $135 a day average to keep someone incarcerated. If we are keeping somebody incarcerated for $78, how is that financially responsible? We have people that are, and again, losing their jobs, that have places in treatment. If it's a $78 bail, they're not a danger to our community, and they should have the right to be out. And so we will continue pushing on this on a legislative level, but also on a local level. We work with national organizations all over the country that are working on bail reform, because it shouldn't matter how much wealth you have. If you are a danger, you shouldn't be able to be in the public. If you don't have wealth, you should still be able to be in a part of our community and fight your case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hunsey. Are there any questions for Ms. Hunsey? Because I do want to make sure you can get on with what you need to do. If not, then thank you for your testimony. So we have questions from Representative Johnson, Lucero, and Mueller. And then I got you. Mr. Johnson, if you can stay here, that would be helpful. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I have a couple different questions. First of all, just a little bit of clarification. Maybe Mr. Johnson can clarify this a little bit better. We have what's a statutory bail with, there's no restrictions, but a lot of judges also put a lower amount of the bail and then have the restrictions, and the person has an option to either go without restrictions or with restrictions. I'm just wondering if I have that correct.
Mr. Chair, members, that's essentially correct. When a person appears before a judge essentially has three options. The judge can release that person on their personal recognizance or own recognizance, which is just essentially that person's promise to return. They can release the person on bail only, set a bail amount with nothing else. Or they can release the person on a conditional release. Conditions of release can vary widely, including no contact orders like we've heard and a variety of other conditions. However, under both the Constitution and the rules of criminal procedure, if a court releases someone under a conditional release, they are required to also set an alternative bail, which can be higher than a bail amount that's imposed with conditions. That's correct.
Senator Johnson?
Hey, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr, I'm looking at the bill 1.11 through 1.14. It says release of a person charged with a misdemeanor offense and a defendant charged. As I'm reading this, if there is a bail, is your intentions of this bill that the person not go to court, not go to jail, and just be basically given a citation or a summons and sent on their way, or should they be booked in jail and go before the judge to have the bail set?
Mr. Chair, this is intended to, as you have heard from the previous testifier,
that if a bail is set, the individual has already been booked. And by going through, I think we need to look deep into when somebody is arrested. They will be booked, and there is going to be a bail set. So in this process, we're asking if it's misdemeanor cases, with the exclusion of the domestic violence, DWI, to be released on their own recognizance. That's the impetus of this bill. That's the intention that we want to create. If this is somebody who's unable to pay $35, we're going to keep them in jail because they cannot afford to pay $35. That's something which is in the inequities that exist in the system that we want to correct and, you know, avail that person other, you know, options so they can get going with their own life and become productive members of the society. That's the intent of this bill.
Representative Johnson, I'm going to ask our public defender, Mr. Ward, to come forward. I think he might be also able to weigh in on your question.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Ward. And you heard some of the questions earlier of being voiced from the MCBW, the Better Women's Coalition.
Yes.
And perhaps you might offer us some thoughts on that as well. Well, why don't we begin with Representative Johnson's question?
I was listening to three different things, Mr. Chair. As far as the question regarding the idea would they be brought in and be booked and released, I think the goal is for people not be brought to the jail, kind of the Hennepin or Minneapolis experience, and that is to provide them with the ability to be released on their own recognizance. I think, Mr. Chair, we're getting a little bit carried away with this idea that somehow that people have committed domestic assault or these serious assaults and they're just being released and not being charged with those crimes. I think, with no disrespect, sir, but the reality is if, in fact, a domestic assault occurs at home or on the street, they're being arrested for domestic assault or whatever the graduate's going to be. That's just the way it is. There is no such thing, in my experience, as a domestic assault or a misdemeanor serious assault happening, and the charging body just decides to do a disorderly conduct. That's just not real world. It's charged out as a domestic. What happens rarely is someone is in custody or through plea negotiations where the prosecutor talks to a complainant or if you talk to a client that if a person has been in custody or has pled to a reduced charge of a disorderly or a nonviolent, then the court might consider bail conditions at that time. But that's the anomaly. That's just not the rule. So I implore you to understand what actually happens day in and day out in the entire system is if someone's seeing a domestic, they're arrested, or the call, a 911 call is a domestic, or the neighborhood calls on a domestic, the person's charged with a domestic. There is not a charging body in the entire state that is not going to charge that and charge of disorderly conduct instead. So I appreciate the concerns regarding that and about the idea that somehow going forward that this people are being lost in the system. It simply is not true. The other thing I want to comment on is I do think it's a little ludicrous to think that the victim is not considered as part of public safety. That is the argument that is used every single day in every single courthouse in the state. Public safety includes the complainant, includes the definition of what we call a victim. So public safety encompasses the idea of the complainant as well. Lastly is the system is very clear that if, in fact, a person is arrested for a domestic or for an assault, they can ask for an order of protection or a DANCO at that time. Those are issued. Those are conditions of release. Those are conditions of bail. It happens every day in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. I was going to ask about the order for protection issue. Representative Johnson, you have a...
Yeah, I think to continue on with this a little bit, Mr. Chair, the way I'm reading this in line 1.15, if the court determines that there is substantial likelihood that the defendant will not appear at the future court appearance, the court must impose. With what they're proposing, the person would never get to court unless they were, on every misdemeanor, booked into the jail and held there before the court. This is going to increase our court time. This is going to increase our court costs. This bill is actually going to fill up our jails. Right now, because on every misdemeanor, it's not the police officer that decides. It's the courts that decide. In order for the courts to decide, they have to go before the court. The judge, the police officer is not the court. The court is the judge. And the only way the judge can make those determinations is when he's performing at the bench.
Mr. Lord? Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not really sure of why you would think that this is going to increase people's time in jail or being before the court now. They are being brought before court now. There are few jurisdictions currently in the state that allow the police to provide the personal recognizance plan. There are very few. The reality is, every day, I mean, in the PSF, they have 300 people in there a day, 150 people there a day. In every jail, I have lawyers, as you know, we've asked for the money for that, to be assigned to the courthouse to represent people on first appearances. So I don't see how it's going to increase people, the population of people in the jail for first appearance. The goal is that if you're poor on a nonviolent offense, that you should be able to be released to make sure you come back at a following date.
Mr. Wallace, I wonder if you can come forward because the issue of cost has been raised. And so I think there's some information on the fiscal note here.
Mr. Chair, I've only brought one copy of the fiscal note with me if anybody wants to see it. I have doodled all of it.
I can send an email right now to everybody.
But Mr. Chair, I'm going to skip to the end and quote from the judicial branch. If the provisions of this bill result in 100% increase in bail hearings, the additional hearings would not require an additional judge FTE based on the judicial branch weighted caseload data. Thus, the bill is not anticipated to have a significant fiscal impact on the judicial branch. I believe they're saying that it's not going to make a material difference to the courts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple questions for the bill author. First is, you don't have any data on what is expected, the numbers that this would impact?
Mr. Chair, I've requested the numbers. I've not received the actual numbers, but it's something that I've seen almost every day when I go to the court system. So there's somebody who's being charged and they cannot pay the $78.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who did you request the numbers from, and what will the scope of those numbers be? Will it be county? I'm not talking dollars. I'm talking the number of people that would be released, perhaps on a county-by-county basis, on an annual basis.
Mr. Wallace, I think you might have some information in that note.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, just quoting from the note here, it says there are an average of 7,473 misdemeanor bail hearings statewide each year.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next question is, there are exclusions, and the amendment did add two additional exclusions. Of the exclusions that are there and with the amendment, adoption of the amendment, is fifth-degree arson in your exclusions?
Representative
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Johnson can help us.
Sure.
Let me get you the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, fifth-degree arson is not one of the listed exceptions.
Thank you. How about fourth-degree criminal damage to property?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, again, fourth degree criminal damage to property is not one of the listed exceptions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then to the bill author, why are you okay with people being released for those two crimes, just as an example?
Mr. Chair, the issue is not about being released. It's about somebody can afford to pay the cash bail. Right now, I'm assuming the two conditions that you just mentioned, someone can be released on a cash bail, as we speak right now. And so this issue of, protecting the victims of domestic violence, people who are going to create harm in the community, is our intention. So when something has already, occurred, somebody who's committing an arson or something like that, the bail is already going to be set for that individual. So is it a misdemeanor case? Yes. So they can be released on their own recognizance, and if they're not, according to the bill, we're looking into the public safety again. If there is a public safety issue, I think the judges have got a leeway to address that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then my question for the bill author is, again, you made a judgment call, and it's subjective as to what you want to exclude in terms of not being released with bail. They'd be released in their personal recognizance of attorney, but you didn't include others, and again, that's subjective. I think arson in the fifth degree, which is a misdemeanor, might be one of those that should have an exclusion where they would not be released as well. Criminal damage to property being another example. And so to the prior conversation that Representative O'Neill and others were in, and has been brought up already, I think it's very alarming when there are unintended consequences, there's things that you don't think about, And that's one of the reasons that I had great pause with this, because this is so vast in scope, and there's, despite the great members and great minds in this committee, there are things that we're not going to think about, scenarios, that people will be released, and it isn't what we want. So I'm very concerned with that. Then I guess the last question, Mr. Chair, is, what is the process that the court would go through to determine? You know, what mechanism does the court have in a misdemeanor case to determine the likelihood? Right, that's the actual language. To determine the likelihood that a defendant will not appear.
I'm going to ask Mr. Ward, who actually practices in court, to make a stab at answering your question, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I suspect Representative Pinnell can also answer the same question. They have MNSIS, the Minnesota Court Information System, has all the information you could possibly want an individual in the state who's been charged with a crime. It lists out the warrants. It lists out certainly if they've been past failures to appear. But also part of the inquiry would be for the court, if the person comes before the court, is do they have sufficient ties to the community? Are they employed? Do they work? What part of the community they live in? Are they from the state? We have these issues every day on the borderline communities. So community corrections, Department of Corrections, the courts all make very good inquiry right now about those issues if it is a concern to them based upon past failure to appear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am concerned about some of the things that Mr. Carlson raised with respect to the Better Women's Coalition, but I do have a question for you, Mr. Ward, and I know you said that the public safety would encompass the victim, but I know that the Rules of Criminal Procedure 602 talk about, they list the victim separately. So they have the victim safety, any other person's safety, and then the community safety. So in the rules, they're separating those out. So I guess I can understand MCBW's concern that maybe the victim wouldn't be included just because that's how the rules are laid out. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I can certainly search the case law for you to find out whether or not the U.S. or the Minnesota Supreme Court or Appellate Court has looked at it the same way. I just know, and as you're a practitioner, I know what happens in court every day. And the courts, nor do the prosecutors in some way distinguish between the complainant and public safety. That is a discussion that's held every single day in every court house in the state, and I've not heard it being distinguished that way in the past.
Mr. Chair, yeah, and I appreciate that, and I just I really like what this bill is mm-hmm. intended to do, so I just want to say that. But the other question I have is maybe for Mr. Johnson, because it says at the top, if there's a conflict between the rules of procedure or this section could control. And then I'm thinking about separation of powers issues, and can we as the legislature say that this statute would trump the rules of procedure? I know the courts have been very protective of their rules over the years. And I don't know that that's a question, just something I wanted to comment on, as just when I read this bill, I was thinking, oh, what litigation is this going to be to?
We're keeping you awfully busy.
I know.
That's why I'm here. Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, and members, there's no way to definitively answer that question. The legislature has the power and the authority to establish substantive rights. The courts have the power and the authority to establish the procedural rights. The question will be, is this a substantive right or a procedural right? I think that there could be compelling arguments made on both sides. Ultimately, of course, it is the courts that determine whether it creates a substantive or a procedural right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we have three members, and then I'm going to move to a vote. Representative Johnson, Representative Constantine, and Representative Pinfield. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I have two questions. First of all, Representative Knorr, I'm just wondering which state, if any, that this bill is patterned after? Because I know it's a push across this country. I'm just wondering if there's a particular state that this is passionate.
Mr. Chair, there's not. I know some states have pushed even the whole cash bail system, but this is there's nothing similar to this.
Thank you.
Chair
Mariani, I guess the other issue I had is
is currently the courts have come up with a bail schedule. A different offense, certain offenses, they allow cash bail. So they don't have to go to court. If they post their bail, they can leave without any issue. And if they can't post their bail, they'll go to court. Now, is it the intent of this bill to get rid of that opportunity set up by the judicial system that actually works overall very well? Because if they can't post their bail, they do go before the judge. If we are getting rid of that system, we're looking at everybody that's brought into jail before they can be released, having to go before the judge to be released on their own personal recognizance. Otherwise, the judge has to make the decision instead of having the opportunity for the person to get out of jail before they have to go to court.
I'm going to ask the practitioner to comment.
Mr. Chair, or committee members, it's difficult to comment on in some respects. I appreciate what you're trying to say. You know, the first question was Mr. Johnson about what is this model after, and I would say it's actually a minimalist bill compared to what other jurisdictions have done. Today, for instance, in Philadelphia, there's a study that was released that showed that by implementing something that's similar but not but much more robust than this, there's been zero increase in recidivism, and there's been a better appearance in court after being released on their own recognizance. So when you say, and I appreciate your comments, that the system works well, I would tell you that as a practitioner, it does not work well. It works well for the wealthy. And my clients, 155,000 cases a year, are not wealthy. And so for the folks who are poor, this system does not work well for them at all. The goal of this is to give them the opportunities to not be separated from their families, to not lose their jobs, to not lose their housing, to not lose their benefits. And as the idea is to have them be back on the streets as soon as possible. The idea that somehow this is going to increase the load of the courts, I just don't see it as a practitioner. I really don't. The idea of issuing a warrant for somebody's arrest on a nonviolent misdemeanor because they failed to appear in court, I think is using a sledgehammer to deal with a very minor issue. The reality is, as the studies show, people do respond and do come back to court. Obviously, in greater Minnesota, it's oftentimes a transportation issue that we're dealing with. But the idea of issuing a warrant, which I guarantee you, in so many jurisdictions, is going to be a no-bail or body-only warrant to come back on a misdemeanor. What does that achieve? I think that this bill, and I've said it before, achieves a lot of great good. I believe that everyone in here can come up with anecdotal stories as to how it's going to fail. But the reality is that the guts of this bill are truly dealing with people who should not be in custody. They are disorderly conduct cases. They are loitering cases. I mean, their failure to appear on a driving after suspension case. These folks should be released with the opportunity to come back. And a summons and a warrant isn't going to increase by the data, and I'm more than happy to provide the data to you from the other studies that shows that by releasing people out on bail without having to pay, letting them outside of that jail, they will come back to court, which is exactly what this bill is intending to do.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I guess. Chair Mariani.
Mr. Chair.
It's been a long day.
It's an honor to be referred to by the other gender. Yes, chair.
I personally have to disagree with you with this last testimony. I've arrested many low-income people. A lot of times, with the bail schedule, they're out of jail long before I even get done, even started with the reports I have to write. The judges in our court system have done a very good job putting our bail schedule together. The other states, going through a report I have here, that have done bail reform, it's done the exact opposite. More people in jail, more time in courts. It does more disparity in the people sitting in the jails. So we gotta be, if we're going to do something, we have to make sure we do it right and not rush things through. We have a good system. I don't know where you were. I've never had anybody. In fact, I don't think in my years in law enforcement even saw somebody with a bail that amount. That you're talking $35, $70. I have not seen them in my 27 years career in law enforcement. If they're doing that, maybe the city that's city prosecutor that's doing that should look twice what they're doing and double-checking that. But I generally haven't had an issue with the system. It's worked very well. And in greater Minnesota, it works very well.
Members, the chair wants to take up the amendment, if it's going to be offered, the A3 amendment. We had a signal a few minutes ago that Mr. Grasso may be offering it. So I want to give you the opportunity, sir, to do that if that's your intent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at House Files 741, A1 amendment. I'd like A3. I'm sorry.
All right.
A3 amendment. The amendment to his current law, House File 741, is based on the premise that defendants will show up for their court date without the forfeiture of bail as a safeguard. I think we need to reinforce the seriousness of being charged with a crime and that defendants need to show up for their court date. The A3 amendment puts the rule, Section 3 of the court rules of criminal procedure in the bail statute, since language in House Bill 741 supersedes the rules of criminal procedure. We need to make sure that if a defendant doesn't show up for court, there's some reinforcement there that they know that there will be a warrant or some warrant written for them, and law enforcement will arrest them. And I call this the Fool Me Once Amendment, and I ask for your support, sir.
Very well. There is an amendment to the amendment, the A4 amendment. I believe Representative Pinto, that's your amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair, and with great respect to Representative Grasso, my concern about the A4, my concern about the A3 is that most of it is just repeating the rule, and I hate to do that because we have the rule already. The difference is, the concern I have is in lines 1.5, it requires that the court issue a warrant rather than a summons if there's certain circumstances. And in my experience, in some of those circumstances, it may be appropriate to issue a summons. So if the defendant fails to appear to schedule a court hearing, court finds out that, in fact, the person has a surgery, whatever, in the hospital, whatever it is. Like, so just situations arise, right? And the court says, okay, we're going to issue a summons, we're going to do something relating to this, but we're not going to issue a warrant. I just worry that this is not giving courts enough discretion and opportunity to fashion the appropriate, whether a warrant or a summons, to kind of fit the particular circumstances. And so that's the concern I have, again, with respect to Representative Grasso. But my thought would be that we've got Rule 6.03 of the rules, and it works well, and rather than repeating it and then having this increased imposition, I'd prefer to simply allow the court to follow Rule 6.03 and think that's sufficient. So I'd offer the A4.
Representative Grasso.
Well, I just want to make sure that if we are going to be releasing people on their own recognizance, Mr. Chair and Committee, that when there is a court date set, that they do understand that they have been charged with a crime and that it is imperative that they do show up.
Very well. All in favor of the amendment to the amendment, the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Representative Brown, we now return to the A3 amendment. This is an amendment to the amendment. A3 amendment as amended. Any further discussion? All in favor of the A3 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Doerr, your bill is before us. Oh, very well. Okay. Before we move to the vote, Representative Bowler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said, I really support the intent behind this bill, and I do plan on voting yes for it now, but I really do hope you work with MCDW on language that's acceptable to them, and I hope that you reach out to the County Attorneys Association, too, to see if they have any suggestions for language.
Representative Noor, why don't we get you on the record in terms of the response to Representative Bowler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I've met with the representative from the County Association. I'm willing to work with them and get them, to really vet the bill that we have, which I believe it's a good bill that addresses a big challenge that we have. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, I could request a roll call on this.
Roll call has been requested. And Representative Noor, you get the last word here.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said before, this is an equity issue. This is criminalizing poverty. And this bill will really help address some of those minor cases where somebody cannot afford to pay $78, as we have had $35, just to sit in jail because they cannot be released on their own recognition. So I ask for your support and to get this bill through. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Very well. So, Representative, thank you, Representative Dorn. Thank you for bringing this to scale. And I want to thank all the testifiers, both pro and con, on the bill last week and also this evening. With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 741, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee, and a roll call has been called for. And so the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Christensen?
Absent.
Considine?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Grossel?
No.
Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Lesch?
Aye.
Sorry.
Aye.
Long?
Yes.
Lucero?
No.
Miller?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Nash?
Nope.
O'Neill?
No.
Pinto?
Yes.
Colston?
No.
Very well. A vote of 9 affirmative and 7 opposed, the motion prevails. And with that, members, this committee stands adjourned until tomorrow.